Yo, check this out, man.
For a minute that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. Who, you know, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
Gonna rise up, take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting August 4th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
As reported in the San Francisco Herald on this date, August 4th, 1869, San Francisco land speculator Emperor Norton I declares the United States dissolve, and the greatest and wise ruler of the United States abolishes both Democratic and Republican parties. He's quoted in the paper as saying, "Party strife now exists within the realm. I do hereby dissolve and abolish Democratic and Republican parties, and also do hereby decree the disfranchisement and imprisonment for not more than 10 years and no less than 5 years to all persons leading to any violation of this your imperial decree." So remember, when you go out and vote Democrat or Republican this coming year, you're going to be in violation of the emperor's decree. Wouldn't want to do that now. In other empire news, in 1925 on this date, U.S. Marines leave Nicaragua after 13 years of occupation. Don't worry, they'll be back again and again. Also on August 4th, 1944, Netherlands, Nazi police in Amsterdam, acting on an informant's tip, discover Anne Frank and the family in hiding. The eight lived in a single secret room for 728 days, then were sent to the notorious Belsen concentration camp where they were killed except the father. He returned to the house after the war and found Anne's diary. Began at age 12, he recorded the feelings and thoughts, pressures and fears, while coming to age during 2 years of hiding from death. Translated in over 30 languages, is a symbol of strength and how brutal humans can be to other humans. People,
the
time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Jackie Cook. On this day, August 4th, in 1964, the bodies of American civil rights activists James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman were found in the Mississippi River after disappearing 2 months earlier. The three young activists had traveled together to Mississippi to register black voters and investigate the bombing of a black church. After being arrested for supposed speeding, they were released onto a dark, remote road and greeted by carloads of Ku Klux Klan members. The Klansmen shot the two Jewish New Yorkers, Schwerner and Goodman. But Chaney, a black Mississippi native, was brutally beaten with chains and mutilated before being shot. The killings received massive media attention and ignited public sympathy. But civil rights activists criticized the publicity, stating that had two of the victims not been white, the case would have been largely ignored. Can you think of any other cases like this? Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, on August 4th, 1988, Congress votes 20,000 each Japanese Americans in turn during World War II. This week in Radical History for August 5th, 1498. What, no kangaroos? Columbus is the first recent European to land in South America continent, and he thinks he landed in Australia. Speaking of colonization in the New World, in this date in 1620, the Mayflower and Speedwell sail away and also do not find Australia. Unfortunately for Native American, they find them instead. Also on August 5th, 1892, Harriet Tubman gets a pension from Congress for her work as a nurse, spy, and scout during the Civil War. She, along with Sojourner Truth and Susie King, and almost 200 other African-American women, served as nurses during the war in 11 hospitals in over three states. Also on August 5th, 1936, James Colton, who married anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman in 1925 to provide her with British citizenship, dies of cancer. Colton, an elderly anarchist from Wales, married Emma so she'd be free from the problems of traveling and giving lectures. Also on this date, 1964, U.S. begins bombing of North Vietnam to protect American interests, of course.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on August 5th, 1990, Bush sends U.S. Marines into Liberia to protect American interests.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality.
This week in Radical History for August 6th, 1855, Bloody Monday riots. A Louisville, Kentucky mob pulling a brass cannon attacks Irish quarter, burning down houses and killing at least 20, the Irish being the Mexicans of our day. Also on August 6, 1890, on Good Friday, of course, the first electric chair execution in the United States happens in Auburn Prison in New York. It was a gruesome execution. It had to be done over and over again. And no, he did not rise in 3 days. Also on August 6, 1927, Massachusetts High Court hears final plea for those anarchist bastards, Sutko and Vizzetti. Protest bombs hit homes of Baltimore mayor and Boston mayor. Their controversial trial attracted numerous international attention, with critics accusing the prosecution and presiding judge of improper conduct, like calling them those anarchist bastards, and allowing of anti-Italian, anti-immigrant, and anti-anarchist sentiment to prejudice the jury. Prominent Americans such as Upton Sinclair publicly sided with the citizen-led opposition to the verdict. The two executed elicited mass protests in New York, London, Amsterdam, Tokyo. Workers walked out across South America, and riots in Paris, Geneva, and Germany, as well as Johannesburg, occurred. Also on August 6, 1945, U.S. drops atomic bomb on a civilian population of Hiroshima, U.S. being the only country to use this massive type of WMD. Destroying homes of almost 400,000 people, the bomb explodes in the air and destroys more than two-thirds of the city's buildings. About half the population is burned in ruins, burned to death by the explosive heat or consumed by fire. Thousands of survivors develop radiation sickness, and in 1 month, hundreds more would die in makeshift hospitals and other weakened buildings crumble around them. There is no practical reason to drop the bomb. It did nothing to shorten the war, and Japan was already trying to negotiate peace with the United States. The United States was simply determined to show Russia who was calling a tune in the post-World War. Also on August 6, 1957, 11 activists from the Committee of Nonviolence Action arrested at Atomic Test Proving Grounds in Nevada, the first of what eventually become thousands arrested in Nevada test site and hundreds of thousands around the world. Also on that date, 1967, Indian Claims Commission awards $12.2 million to 8 Lakota tribes for 29 million acres, most of them in the Upper Great Plains, taken by fraudulent treaties. Also on that date, 1985, USSR begins unilateral moratorium on nuclear testing. U.S. responds by conducting more underground nuclear tests. Then in 1989, U.S. expressed moral outrage at India and Pakistan for similar testing. Also on August 6, 1988, Tompkins Square Park police riot in New York. A videotape of the police riot got five cops indicted, the chief retired, the captain moved out of the 9th precinct, and more cops were disciplined and some fired. Lastly on this date, in 1990, UN Security Council imposed economic sanctions in Iraq. Total deaths of children under age 5 from the cause of sanctions from 1990 to November 1999 was 502,495 deaths of children. This week in Radical History for August 7th, 1854, rumor that all Catholic churches were arsenals brings a mob of axe-wielding Protestants to St. Louis House of Worship. 8 Irish were butchered like cattle and 30 more seriously wounded, the Irish being the Mexicans of our day. Also on August 7th, 1960, Fidel Castro announces plans to nationalize all American holdings. U.S. and the Mafia, which controlled the economy, fights back. And U.S. government takes the moral high ground and begins a nonstop campaign to assassinate Fidel Castro. Also on this date, 1967, Gulf of Tonkin resolution in response to a falsely report of attacks U.S. destroyer passes the House 416-0 and the Senate 88-2, giving LGB extraordinary powers authorizing him to use all necessary steps to win the war in Vietnam. Only two legislatures, Morris and Running, vote against it, with no opposition in the House. Then the FBI begins collecting the names of supporters of Morris, and his office phone lines are tapped. Same war, different year. Also on that date, 1978, the Love Canal subdivision, Niagara Falls, New York, built on a site of former Harker Chemical Company chemical dump, formally declared a toxic disaster area by President Carter. Also on this date, 1979, highly enriched uranium released from a top-secret nuclear fuel plant near Irwin, Tennessee. About 1,000 people are contaminated with up to 5 times as much radiation they would normally receive in any given year. Lastly, for August 7, 1995, due to international pressure, State of Pennsylvania announces the stay of its planned August 17th, execution of political prisoner Mumia Ajumil. U.S. officials avow to silence Mumia at all costs and take extraordinary actions to do so. NPR buckles under the pressure from the right wing. Temple University in Philadelphia, owners of 7 Pennsylvania radio stations, also buckles under pressure, refuses to air tapes in defense of him, cancels contract with Pacifica Network. Free press? Yeah. This week in radical history for August 8th, 1449. Portuguese slaver Henry the Navigator unloads 6 ships of human cargo slaves from Africa. He proclaims it is the, quote, salvation, unquote, of their souls. Also on August 8th, 1879, Mexico, revolutionary hero anarchist Emilio Zapata lives. He'll inspire the Zapatista movement. Zapata will continue to live as long as the people believe that they have the right to their own lands and the right to govern themselves according to their own deeply held beliefs and cultural values. Also on August 8, 1925, a huge KKK rally held in Washington, D.C. The modern-day KKK, known as skinheads, with all the right-wing anti-immigrant sentiment, skinheads are increasing in numbers around the United States and the world. Also on this date, 1942, India National Congress passes Quit India Resolution, leading to mass arrests by their British masters. Two more items for August 8, 1974. Tricky Dick Nixon, no longer claiming he is a crook, announces he'll resign. Said, "I am not a quitter." Then he quits. Also claimed during the Vietnam War to be a pacifist. I guess he got that one wrong, too. Also on that date, 1980, Reagan aide William Casey leaves on his second trip to bribe Iranians to delay the release of U.S. hostage until Reagan takes office. Only got a couple items in This Week in Radical History for August 9th, 1779. General Clinton and 1,500 American troops break dam and flood the Iroquois towns and fields in upstate New York. Troops then burn and ravage settlement for 12 days. Also on that date, 1945, America Fat Boy dropped on Nagasaki. About 70,000 more civilians die immediately. Truman drops the bomb to prove to Russia that he's tough and gets the Cold War arms race off to an unhealthy start. Also on August 6, 1966, 200 sit-in in New York City's offices of Dow Chemical Company to protest the use of napalm in Vietnam. Edward Abbey would say, "A patriot must always be ready to defend his country against his government." Lastly, for August 9, 1997, New York City cops rape and torture Abner Louima, a legal immigrant from Haiti, sodomize him with a plunger. New York cops always practice their own unique form of justice. This week in radical history for August 10th, only got a couple items. 1877, U.S. Army troops under Colonel Gibson attack a sleeping Nez Perce encampment at Big Hole, Idaho, killing over 50 women and children. Also on August 10th, 1893, Chinese are deported from San Francisco under the first Chinese Exclusion Act to exclude Chinese workers from the United States. The Chinese being Irish of that day, the Chinese and Irish being the Mexicans of our day. 1968, 8 American GIs killed by U.S. strafing air in Vietnam. Quote, "Vietnam was the first war ever fought without censorship of the media. Without censorship, things can go terribly confusing in the public mind," unquote. General William Westmoreland, U.S. military commander. Lastly, on the state, 1981, the closing of the Nixon Museum, says manager Pete Mitchell, quote, "If nothing else, it's been a good stopping point for people to use the restrooms between Los Angeles and San Diego." This has been This Week in Radical History. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer, thanks to some audio borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and more radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Thanks for listening to this week's This Week in Radical History, produced at the Glee Glee Studios. And as always, until next week, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
A voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "God, I voted."
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we take another long look at the Palestinian right of return, a right carved in international law that is non-negotiable in any kind of proposed settlement between Palestine and Israel. And like our Bill of Rights, guarantees rights which extend to the individual. You are about to hear excerpts from a forum at the Right of Return Conference held at the NYU Law School a few months ago. It begins with an introduction of both the issue and the speakers.
I want to start by thanking NYU Students for Justice in Palestine, as well as all the co-sponsors for this event, Palestine Works, the Center for Human Rights and Social Justice here at the law school, the student chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, as well as Law Students for Human Rights, for really facilitating this very important conversation. I think the right of return is often not discussed, and it remains one of the most fraught issues that are really at the heart of the current dispute. For Palestinians, the right of return represents a core right. And for many, this conflict will not be resolved until you deal with the reality today, where Palestinian refugees are denied the right to return to their ancestral homeland, while the law of return in Israel allows members of the Jewish community in the United States or in any other country to move to Israel and to become citizens on the spot. Whereas for Israelis, for many Israelis, the right of return represents a political question, a non-starter, and a threat to the existential identity of the state. And as Aman alludes to as well, we deal with a situation where Palestinian refugees represent actually a number larger than the population of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So while so much discussion focuses on the situation in the occupied territories, the reality remains that unless you have a viable, sustainable solution for the Palestinian refugee crisis, you will not ever fully resolve this question. So it's an important conversation, but thankfully we have a really incredible group of people here today to discuss it. So starting to my immediate left, we have Emilio David, who is a Palestine Law Fellow at Columbia University Center for Palestine Studies during the Curtin year. He's also the Director of International Law and the Human Rights Program at Al-Quds University, and his work aims to shed light on the role that judicial phenomenon play in sociological and anthropological questions, and more specifically on the disciplinary powers of law and the discourse of human rights in contemporary colonial Palestine. Emilio will be speaking second in addressing the PA's legislation and policy around the right of return. To Emilio's left, we have, of course, Jamil Dakhwar, who is director of the ACLU's human rights program, where he oversees human rights research, documentation, advocacy, and litigation before international human rights bodies. Before joining the ACLU, Jamil was with Human Rights Watch, and he previously worked at Adala, who, as I'm sure is familiar to many in the room, a very prominent organization, and he has filed and argued human rights cases before Israeli courts and international fora. To Jamil's left, we have Michael Litwin, a lifelong activist. Michael is a public defender in Brooklyn, former president of the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys in UAW Local 2325, and co-founder of Labor for Palestine and Jews for Palestinian Right of Return. He also has participated in attorney delegations to Palestine, Egypt, and in successful campaigns for Stevie Wonder to observe the BDS movement and the boycott of Israeli Zimline ships more recently. I should have mentioned Jamil will speak first after Michael's introduction and discuss the issue of displacement and return in Israel today. And Michael will round out the panel by talking about how activists are responding to the marginalization of the right of return and also how the right in return fits into larger human rights advocacy. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Michael to give a brief introduction to the Palestinian refugee question, and then we'll begin with our speakers.
It's an honor to be here with distinguished fellow panelists, and particularly I want to thank the organizers of this event, Aman, Omar, and NYU Students for Justice in Palestine, especially for having braved the witch hunt type atmosphere that seeks to silence supporters of Palestinian rights so much today that I know you mentioned, or was mentioned earlier at NYU, but is much broader than that. And I just want to start by saying that, you know, in 1964, there was a free speech movement throughout the University of California to advocate civil rights for black people, which was shut down by the university. That the advocacy was until this mass movement, the free speech movement, developed. And today, 52 years later, there really is a new free speech movement, and that free speech movement is to advocate the rights of Palestinians. And this explains, I think, the solidarity in recent times between black freedom activists, actually going all the way back to the 1960s, with Palestinians, and which has been reclaimed today in the form of groups like Black for Palestine, which arose from Ferguson and the Black Lives Matter movement. And as been mentioned earlier, the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom is refugees' right of return, as reflected in UN Resolution 194, which I know will be mentioned and discussed in more detail by the other panelists, as well as in the three demands of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, movement, that calls for not only an end to the occupation of Palestinian land and full equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, but above all, for the right of return of refugees throughout historic Palestine. And I think the purpose of this conference and this discussion is to explain why that is and how, or at least to shed some light on it. And by way of getting at why, it seems to me we have to start with what. And the what are 7 million, the number of Palestinian refugees today, who constitute 70% of the entire Palestinian people, many in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. Interestingly, the majority of these refugees still live within 60 miles of their historic homeland. Indeed, 80% of the 1.8 million people in Gaza, what has been called the world's largest open-air prison, are refugees from 1948 Palestine, what Palestinians and many others call what the Israeli state claims to be. And that includes, by the way, the village of Sderot, where supposedly the Israelis are constantly being bombarded by Palestinian missiles, supposedly. Interestingly, that's a village a place that was founded in 1951 on lands that belonged to the Palestinian Arab village of Najd, which was destroyed by the Israeli state. Which brings us into how and why. In a word, Zionism, the establishment of a Jewish state and the artificial creation and maintenance of a Jewish majority in 1948 Palestine through the forced removal of the indigenous Palestinian people. That's why there are 7 million Palestinian refugees. Think Indian removal and manifest destiny in the United States, and you'll have a pretty good idea of what that has meant in Palestine. In 1948, this Jewish state was established through the Nakba, or catastrophe, which consisted of erasure and occupation of more than 500 Palestinian towns and villages, dispossession of over 750,000 Palestinians, in a terror campaign of which the massacre at Deir Yassin is emblematic. Since 1967, Israel has occupied and colonized the remainder of historic Palestine. And today, this, as you will hear from the other panelists, this relentless ethnic cleansing continues, armed and financed by the United States, our own government, and its allies. And this has created a diaspora of Palestinian refugees that is reflected in this well-known map, Palestinian land loss, that shows how settler colonialism in Palestine has reduced Palestinian land ownership. And you, there are maps very similar to this in regard to Native American land loss in this country. And the same could be said of other settler colonial societies. Because this Jewish state cannot exist without this ongoing ethnic cleansing, Zionists insist on the surrender of Palestinian right of return. Conversely, those who uphold human rights believe that refugees' right of return is essential, fundamental, and non-negotiable. As BDS founder Omar Barghouti puts it, quote, "The right of return is a basic right that cannot be given away. It's inalienable." That's why I work with Al Ouda in New York, the Palestine Right of Return Coalition. That's why I'm here today for Jews for Palestinian Right of Return. And with that, I will turn it over to my fellow panelists.
Let me start with thanking the organizers and the law school's Student for Justice in Palestine for bringing this important event. And I agree, we often hear more about the noise is more about suppression of speech and denying those kinds of conversations to take place than actually dealing with the substance of what is the right of return, what is the issue of occupation, what is the right to equality for Palestinian citizens, etc. So this is a really important opportunity. I'm glad to be here. I should also start by saying that I'm speaking not on behalf of the ACLU. The ACLU, as a U.S. organization, does not take positions on foreign policy matters, particularly on violations of human rights in other countries, notwithstanding the important role that the United States plays in supporting the State of Israel. But I'm speaking here more in my personal capacity, based on my experience and work as a staff attorney of Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, as well as my many years of activism, legal activism and otherwise. So let me focus on a particular area that the organizers asked me to focus on today, which is the internally displaced Palestinians who became internal refugees within their own homeland, and specifically speaking or focusing on Palestinian citizens of Israel. Internal displacement within the history of Palestinian is an ongoing, unfortunate, ongoing experience. There's almost not a day that passes without some Palestinian, some form of forced displacement happens in historic Palestine, whether it happens in the Naqab, in the south of Israel, whether it's happening in the West Bank, whether it's happening in other parts of historic Palestine. So this is an issue that has not ceased to take place, and we need to recognize that. But I would want to really share with you the experience of Palestinian citizens of Israel, because it's always neglected angle or neglected part of the Palestinian history and experience. Despite the fact that the Palestinians became citizens of Israel in 1948, and at the time there were about 18-19% of Israel's population, and continue to be about the same size, 19-20%. Of Israel's population, and their existence as citizens did not immunize them, did not give them immunity from being displaced, being denied access to their historical lands, being denied to return to their own homes and lands that they have left or forced to leave during the 1948 war. And that experience is one that requires us to look at the political, legal, and diplomatic effort that went into sustaining by the State of Israel in the very beginning of the state, in the very first years, starting with declaring a state of emergency which, by the way, continues to exist until this day in Israel. So the state of Israel as a whole, I'm not talking about the West Bank or Gaza, I'm talking about Israel proper, continues to this day to be under a state of emergency. The second part was to use both a combination of force, other ways of, during the time of war, spread rumors of massacre going to happen, using all kinds of tactics that are really considered to be terror tactics under the Geneva Conventions that terrorize civilian populations in a time of war, in order to make sure that Palestinians, as many Palestinians, leave their land and their property and their houses and cities and towns, and make sure that at the time the Zionist militias and the Zionist groups would take over those areas. And we don't have the time to go through the details of what happened during the war, because there's a lot of historians now have well documented, including Israeli historians, by the way, known as the new historians, that clearly show, in particular I want to mention Ilan Pappe as the one who consistently documented the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And as part of that process, there had to be also a way of legal regime in order to make sure that those Palestinian refugees who, for different reasons, left their homes and lands, were again forced, left, as it happens in every war, and I don't think that anyone would think that you would stay in your place put, despite the fact that you would be under the threat of being killed, being injured or massacred, to make sure that those individuals would not make it back, or at the very least would not be able to establish the same kind of relationship, whether it's a legal property rights or access of rights of freedom of movement, and able to establish some sort of precedent for the Palestinians to claim their land and property back. So the idea was, from the very beginning, as was mentioned earlier, seeing the right of return as an existential threat for the state of Israel. And that meant that that existential threat means not necessarily that by the return of Palestinian refugees, all of a sudden those refugees will be holding arms and will be killing Jews, but rather existential threat in changing the landscape of the state of Israel into one where there are people who would have to share the land on equal basis, where the privileges and the extra rights that were given under the State of Israel laws, starting with the law of a law of return and many other laws, would not break that kind of system of first-class citizenship for Israeli Jews and a second-class citizenship that has been afforded to Palestinian citizens. And particularly I want to mention the following. The fact that as many as 85% of the Palestinians, citizens of Israel, who remained within the state of Israel shortly after 1948, were living in areas that were declared as military areas. And these areas were three major areas, one in the north that covered major parts of the Galilee, one in the center, which covered major parts of the Triangle area, and one in the south, which covered big parts of the Negev, of the Nakba. And for that, that meant also to use additional laws under the state of emergency state situation in order to make sure that some areas will be declared closed military areas, some property would be confiscated under different rationales. One, for example, would be based under the absentee property law, which the Israeli Knesset passed in 1950. It replaced a temporary emergency law that was in place between 1948 to 1950. And basically, it allowed the Israeli authorities to confiscate the land, or to take custody over the land and to hand it over to the custodian of absentees, and that land was not transferred to the state yet until the Israeli Knesset had to pass another law in order to do that. Another form of prevention of Palestinian citizens who were part of the community of Palestinian communities who were pushed out and forced out of their communities. One other way was to declare some of those the areas closed military areas, similar to what we hear now happening in the West Bank. And as such, that kind of technique or that kind of method allowed the state to say, well, you as a Palestinian, even though you are a citizen, you can access this particular land. And if you had to access that, actually you had to get a permit because there was a permit system that was established under the military regime that existed between 1948 and 66. And because you are not, and later on, because the land was not used, cultivated, the Israeli authorities found the legal pretext to confiscate the land because the land was not used and cultivated, or for other national security reasons, whether the land was close to the border. What is important to remember in this struggle is that the internally displaced Palestinians that in 2000 numbered about 250,000, now they're about roughly 450,000 or so, and they live in different parts of the country, continue to have attachment and deep connections to their ruined and destroyed villages and communities. Although they had to relocate and live in those Palestinian villages that survived the 1948 war, and you're talking about in 1948, you're talking about over 400 Palestinian villages and towns that were completely destroyed. And so some of the residents who were fortunate and lucky enough to be able to relocate and stay or even come back from neighboring Arab countries during the years between 1948 and the mid-50s were left with the option of living in current Palestinian towns and villages, like Nazareth, that absorbed a big number of internally displaced Palestinians. It's important also to mention that the Palestinians never said that we don't want to go back. They always wanted to exercise. And in fact, every year, Palestinians commemorate the Nakba by going to their ancestor lands, by going to their villages. Usually there's a national rally in one of those destroyed villages. And there's a lot of organizing going on, particularly under the umbrella of the National Committee on the Defense of the Rights of Internally Displaced Persons, or Palestinians, that started its activism in the mid-90s, following the Oslo Accords that completely ignored or completely sidelined the rights of Palestinian refugees, and in particular the rights of Palestinian internally displaced. So with that in mind, I wanted to, I don't know how much time we have left. I wanted to give you another example of a case study of how does actually that happen, in fact, for the Palestinian internally displaced. I want to give you an example of a village that that is very close to the Lebanese-Israeli border now in the north of Palestine, called Ikrit. Ikrit is a Palestinian Christian village. Many people think that, you know, Palestinian people is only about one ethnic or religious group. Rather, it is actually very diverse. And one of the many Palestinian refugees were actually also coming from Palestinian, predominantly Palestinian Christian communities or villages. But the history of it is that if you go back to the history that was now more documented by historians, they show that Israeli authorities and Israeli Zionist groups and the government, as it started in after its declaration in 1948, tried to avoid harming and forcing out Palestinian Christian communities because of the threat of a backlash in the international public opinion, particularly upsetting, you know, the Western countries, upsetting the Church, the Vatican, etc. And that has some maybe that may explain the reason why. There were more Palestinian, relatively speaking, more Palestinian Christian communities who were able to survive the war and to stay and remain in their country. Now, that doesn't mean that there were no displacements and denial of the right to return for Palestinian Christians. As all Palestinian communities, regardless of religion, they were subject to the same plan of making sure that we would liberate those territories, take over, take control, military control over their territories, and make sure that we maintain as fewer number of Palestinians as possible. Because the idea of the Zionist project was to realize the Zionist project in the creation of a state of Israel that predominantly is a Jewish, or maintains a Jewish majority, is a Jewish state for the Jewish people. And the existence of non-Jews, and in fact you would hardly hear or see in the history of the records of the state of Israel reference to the words Palestinians. They would be either called non-Jews, they would be either called referred by their own religions, because Israel, after all, is a sectarian state, or they would be called, you know, all kinds of terminologies now used, Israeli Arabs, Arabs Israelis, and stuff like that, just to negate or to diminish the Palestinian identity of this community. And that plan included orders that were given to commanders and military commanders to do that. So those communities that were able to take refuge in nearby villages, my grandfather, who was participating in the hostilities as part of the local committees in the north, was in the fight, in the battlefield. My grandmother took her two sons and took refuge in an Arab Druze village near their town. And they were able to come back after the war was over, but my grandfather was still in detained as a prisoner of war in some camps that were actually where forced labor was done. And this is now documented, something that has been recently revealed as part of the International Committee of the Red Cross opening their archives in Geneva. And the case of Ikret is one that is interesting, because you see where even when the internally displaced Palestinians had a promise by the military commander to leave their village, to go and stay in a nearby village, in the village of Arami, while the hostilities end, while the war is until the war is over. Yet they were not able to get back to their own country, and despite the fact that they were citizens. So, for that matter, citizenship really did not give them an extra right other than the ability to remain and to, despite all the challenges and restrictions, even to file illegal challenges to the Israel Supreme Court. And in fact, the communities of Ikret filed a petition, one of the early petitions to be filed on behalf of internally displaced, as did other communities, Al-Ghabsiyyi and others. But Ikret's did particularly is important for legal scholars and lawyers, because the Supreme Court in the early days of the early 1950s actually did say that they have a certain right of return, and that they had a promise, and that promise should be fulfilled, while at the same time the Israeli government took the decision to destroy their village. And they were not, and they declared the village entirely a closed military area, claiming that there was a national security reason for doing so, because it's very close to the Lebanese border. There were all kinds of infiltrators, Palestinian infiltrators, those inhabitants, native indigenous Palestinians, who were refugees trying to come back to their homeland, were forced by force stopped from coming in, coming back. And as a result, they were continued to struggle for the return. Their struggle obviously took a different nature because they are citizens. And then during the 1990s, there was another attempt. I'm going to skip that part, but there was another attempt to go to the court during the Begin government. And they had been told that for national security reasons, we defer to the government for their displacement, and they will not be able to go back. But hopefully, if things get better, they should return to their village. Subsequently, after the beginning of the Oslo Accords, the community continued to struggle for the return. And they said, while at the same time, a lot of the land was already taken and used by Jewish communities in that area. And the only two landmarks that remained in Ikrit, if you go, you can actually go and visit them today, is the cemetery and the church, and where people continue to bury their loved ones in that cemetery and go to the church wherever they are. You know, they marry people there. They go to the different sermons. But the point is, they were not able to go back, and only after specific advocacy, because of the fact that the Supreme Court in the early years determined that they actually have the right to go back to their land, the government was able to establish a ministerial committee that recommended to come to a plan where it will accommodate and will provide some sort of a plan for them to go back, but it will not include all of the land that was part of the village. It will be very limited to a particular area. They would create a communal village on a much very short or very small area, but they will at the same time there will be some sort of a compensation given to others. Ultimately, this plan did not move forward, and it was rejected in terms of some people in the community rejected that as a way of negating the right to of return and full compensation and taking back their own lands, but also because of the political situation has changed in a way that allowed the government to say, no, that is actually not a good idea for us, even for such a small community of hundreds of people that are attached to the village of Ikrit. And the reason was, this is going to set a precedent for Palestinian right of return. And in fact, the last attempt of the village of Ikrit to get another chance before the Israel Supreme Court, Ariel Sharon's government at the time submitted a statement, a declaration, that said the government opposes their return because it fears to create this precedent. And their case has been dismissed, and to this day, they're going back to the organizing, to the ideal of returning, despite the fact that their laws or the courts have not been able to provide them with any remedy. So this is one example that represents the best scenario for, or best case for, Palestinian internally displaced, where they were not given any remedy, were not given any the recognition and the exercise of the right of return. And now Palestinians as a whole, internally displaced, continue to organize and think about ways of achieving, realizing their right as part of the Palestinian vision toward the future. 10 years ago, and I will close with that, 10 years ago, there were a number of important documents that were adopted by the Palestinian civil society, political leadership in Israel. They were called the vision documents. And those documents speak about the historic injustice that happened to the Palestinian people, but specifically focus on Palestinian rights within Israel. And they specifically address land and housing planning policies and the injustice that happened to the Palestinians with regard to confiscation of their land, particularly to internally displaced Palestinians. And in those documents, there are demand on Israel not only to recognize them, to recognize the injustice, pay reparations, end structural racism, and end all these laws that confiscated land, but there's a specific demand for the state of Israel to look at the historic injustice that was done to the internally displaced Palestinians and to deal with this issue as part of the reconciliation, as part of making Israel a democratic state that is truly committed to equal citizenship while recognizing the right of all people in that country. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamil. I want to hand it over next to Amidio.
Thank you. Thank you so much to the organizers for considering me for this event. In my work in Palestine at the International Law and Human Rights Program in East Jerusalem, I have been insistently trying to advance a more critical scholarship on internal Palestinian law, PA's law. Basically, this has been totally ignored. But I said that I have been trying to advance some more critical scholarship on Palestinian PA's law, because for a strange reason, some of them understandable, these PA laws have been somehow ignored by critical scholarship, and many times I have found myself trying to justify why I'm working on a PA's legislative production. Many people say, what is the importance? We are under occupation, we don't have an state, so what is the importance of PA laws? Why are you studying that? I think you are losing your time. Some people ask me in what sense has Palestinian PA legal production changed, even slightly, the real life of Palestinian people. And I would like to try to respond to this question. How or has effectively Palestinian PA laws changed anything on the ground? To this question, I would like simply to reply, at the risk of raising eyebrows, that PA's legal regime, though it did not deliver its promises, and that I can agree, has participated in the transformation of almost every aspect of our life that Oslo brought about in occupied Palestine and beyond. Oslo, the inception of the PA and its legal structures, carried with them a new cognitive grid for social meaning and political action. And that strongly impacted on refugees' fate. These transformations are of material, symbolic, and discursive nature. They advance categories of perception, violently departing from those before Oslo. And their pervasive impact explain that Palestinian contemporary politics is not fully understandable within the pre-Oslo categories of social and political meaning. Indeed, how to explain otherwise that demonstrations, for example, in Ramallah to support Palestinian prisoners in hunger strike would gather only a handful of supporters, while people continue shopping and very often seem to have only disdain for the demonstrators. How to explain, how else to explain that today Fatah, for example, can see Israel as a potential ally in their fight against Hamas? How can we understand that Palestinian security services repress and torture Palestinians to protect Israel, share intelligence and assist Israeli security services in their own repression of Palestinians? How to explain that Abbas and other public officers can publicly insist and defend the sacred nature of security coordination with Israelis without being unanimously labeled as traitors and punished in the way that they were before Oslo? How to make sense of the fact that prominent members of the Palestinian bourgeoisie in occupied Palestine can host and offer dinners in their own houses to Israeli military officials on the 15th of May to celebrate Israeli independence? How to understand all the ways in which Palestinian elites today normalize relations with Israel in the field of businesses, academia, and politics? All this does not only remind us of Fanon's idea that anti-colonialist struggle is not automatically written from a nationalist perspective, but it also forces us to revisit all these pre-Oslo ideas that we take for granted. without trying to romanticize the history of the Palestinian national movement, the fact is that some old categories of perception in the Palestinian society, which were generally structured around some common experiences, statuses, practices, and objectives, for example, the territorialized national movement, scattered people with the same national objectives and a shared sense of identity, subjected to exile or occupation, and fighting a common enemy, all these have been patently changed or have been redefined. And my point is that severely impacting on the fate of refugees. And my point is that PA laws have contributed to these transformations. Living in Ramallah for the last 8 years and researching on law, I have been directly exposed to the fact that the PA's institutions and legal production are not just the silent and passive products of social and political forces, but they also have a performative ability to produce social reality. First, these legal structures facilitated and consolidated the emergence of new social groups, divisions, hierarchies, etc. Second, the PA's legal regime has advanced new forms and sources of authority, legitimacy, social status, subjectivity, identities, and categories of social meaning that reinforce these changes. Third, legal and institutional processes promoted particular discursive practice and strategies that, while emphasizing the concept of peace process, institutional building, statehood, economic development, and the language of rights and law at the expense of the real end to colonial rule, seemed to progressively reorganize social and political action in and around Palestine. In the symbolic realm, the PA legal structures have not only served to institutionalize, legitimize, and consolidate specific avenues for political and social action that guarantee and reinforce the reproduction of its social order, but they have also contributed to the redefinition of identities. As Combi emphasizes, since identity is not only a matter of the roles of individuals or their own identification, but also of the categorization of individuals or groups by the states, institutions and other groups, identity may also be delineated from the outside. The redefinition of identities produced by Oslo legal structures included the very concept of who is a Palestinian and directly impacted on refugees. Indeed, before Oslo, the prevailing notion of Palestinian was defined by the PLO Charter as those Arab citizens who were normally living in Palestine up to 1947, and every child who was born to a Palestinian father after this date, whether in Palestine and outside. This was a Palestinian. Anyone normally living in Palestine until 1947 and their descendants. Even though this definition has not technically changed, Oslo's frame and laws symbolically, but also practically, has reduced this notion of Palestinians to the inhabitants of the West Bank and Gaza, progressively excluding Palestinians in Israel, refugees and diaspora from the political process. Indeed, this can be metaphorically illustrated by the fact that Article 34 of the amended Basic Law of 2003, the current constitutional text, even if suspended, states that the president, the Palestinian constitution says that the president is elected in a general and direct election by the Palestinian people. Article 97 prescribes that the ruling of the court shall be announced and executed in the name of the Palestinian Arab people. Moreover, the preamble of the draft Basic Law from the very first reading stated that the power and legitimacy of the Basic Law arises from the will of the Palestinian people. In all these cases, the constitutional text is silent on the fact that the only Palestinians who are part of the PA's political and legal processes are the inhabitants of the West Bank and Gaza, whereby excluding the majority of Palestinians living outside the occupied territories, refugees, and diaspora. The electoral law of 95, for example, clarified and strengthened this point by defining an elector as every Palestinian inhabitant of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including Jerusalem. Furthermore, and even though more than 50% of the Palestinian people live outside the Palestinian territory and are forbidden from entering, to be eligible for president or to be elected to the parliament, the electoral law requires voters to have a fixed residential address inside the Palestinian territory. Further exclusion of large parts of the Palestinian people, as understood in the PLO Charter, from the PA's legal and discursive imaginary has been objectified in law. For example, Article 7 of the same electoral law, after establishing the cases in which someone qualifies as a Palestinian for the purposes of voting or running for elections, sets a general condition, which is that the person has not acquired Israeli citizenship, excluding ipso facto Palestinians in Israel. In turn, the law of NGOs of 1999 forbids the participation of Palestinians from Israel in the administration of these institutions. Thus, Palestinians inside Israel maintain a complex relation with the authority characterized by their blurred position in the PA's imaginary and their lack of institutional links with it. Moreover, the status of Palestinians inside Israel was not even discussed in Oslo, neither during the drafting of the Basic Law nor during the drafting of the definitive Palestinian constitution for the state. Even though the identification of the Palestinians inside Israel with the Palestinian cause is not in doubt, there are virtually no trans-border Israel-Palestinian territory structures of Palestinian political mobilization. In this context, the Palestinian organizations inside Israel increasingly orient their work to the defense of their interest as a minority inside Israel, and in these efforts, their interlocutor is primarily the Israeli state. It plays perfectly into the Israeli strategy of disassociating this population from the Palestinian national struggle. Regarding refugees outside Palestine in other countries, it is worth noting that in 96 and 2006 Palestinian elections, no efforts were made to materialize the participation of refugees and diaspora Palestinians. In contrast to the election, to the elections in other countries with similar conditions of occupation such as Iraq and Afghanistan. Not really surprising, given that as early as 1994, Nabil Shaad, ex-foreign minister, stated that, and quote, Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, that was in 94, that Palestinian refugees in Lebanon were not the PA's responsibility, but UNRWA's. In 94, also, Ziad Abu Ziad, PLC member, the PA's parliament, PLC member and PA minister, distinguished between the principle of the right of return and its actual applicability of return to the homeland and to that same home, piece of land, which a certain Palestinian owned before 1948. According to Abu Ziyad, Palestinians should enjoy the principle of the right of return, but its more realistic application would be to attract them to a future Palestinian state. In 2010, Abu Mazen himself declared before a Jewish North American audience, quote, I would never deny the Jewish right to the land of Israel, overlooking the fact that the Jewish right to the land has been based on the denial of the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Indeed, from the beginning of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in Madrid and later in Oslo, Israel imposed as a condition the exclusion of refugees from the discussions. In the agreements themselves, this solution was accepted and the refugee issue was left for final status talks. Moreover, the Oslo agreements simply excluded any reference to the UN General Assembly Resolution 194, to the UN Charter, or international law at all. Later, Arafat himself suggested the idea that the right of return may be renounced for some categories of refugees, and a solution to the refugees within an agreement acceptable to Israel, which meant subjecting Resolution 194 to various interpretations. This evolution in refugee status has brought about an increasing uncertainty regarding who is a Palestinian within the PA institutional frame and in whose name PA officials speak. Refugees have found their rights gradually excluded from the PA's political claims and see with suspicion an authority which is likely willing to give up their rights in order to obtain political results in their bargaining with Israel. I want to conclude by saying that from the PA standpoint, incorporating refugees in the political process has become dangerous in that it may put at stake its own political and institutional power. In this context, one cannot expect but an increasing exclusion of the refugees from the PA's imaginary and political agenda. Thank you.
And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
You must not believe anything that you hear on this show or from the lips of Dan Rather or George Bush or Bill Clinton or anyone else in this entire world, whether you hear it on radio or on television or from the lips of someone standing right in front of you. Listen to everything, believe nothing until you can prove you yourself. You must learn how to find the truth and prove it. If you can't do that, you might as well turn off your radio now.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show. Billy Brooks with economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. From Baghdad to Munich and Normandy, but after the US coup in Brazil, will there be an incident at the Rio Olympics too? With terrorist attacks every week pretty much now in Belgium, France, Germany, are we seeing a return to the 1970s and 1980s strategy of tension, when terrorism and the mainstream media were used to manipulate lawmakers and the mass population into giving up civil rights and turning to the state for protection? Rather than focusing on the circumstances of one, we look at the recent spate of Euro-terror and ask what lessons can we learn from the previous wave of attacks in the 1970s and 1980s? Politicians seem to be sometimes the servants of the banksters, and their resource warrior chums, political parties, who give media barons like Rupert Murdoch anything they want in exchange for positive coverage. So this week we look at so-called blowback. Tony Blair's illegal invasion of Iraq appears to have made innocent people anywhere in Europe the target, where a bomb can go off and kill us, or madmen pop up anywhere and shoot us dead any time, just like Kabul or Baghdad. And we look specifically at the Rio Olympics and ask whether now the Democratic President Dilma Rousseff has been removed by the US, can we expect a terrorist attack there, just as there was at the Munich Olympics in 1972 and the Atlanta Olympics in 1986? Also, capitalism died in 2008, and our economies are only being kept alive with a massive injection of quantitative easing. Money printing, meaning wages and employment are stalling, with work no longer a route out of poverty. Millions of us Britons have become the victims of hidden economic warfare by our own government. Silent weapons for quiet wars. But how does it work? And more importantly, how do we fight back? Plus, we have a clip from Fritz Springmeier, the author of Bloodlines of the Illuminati. Our sister show Dialects back noon every Tuesday. This week we go to Cambry Heath to visit Ian Dumbrell, who's been homeless and living in his car for the last 15 months, despite having a disability that means his leg may have to be amputated. After 15 months of waiting and living in his car throughout last winter, he's finally got a flat from South Gloucestershire Council. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. But Martin, let's start by having a look at this recent spate of terror attacks across Europe, really starting with the most recent one, this brutal killing of a priest in Normandy.
I don't know what you want me to say about it.
One is that the guy was at the top of the terror watch list in France and been released on a tag. Just to sort of run around and do what he wanted.
Yeah, well, I mean, then there are questions of competence or incompetence of the relevant authorities. But, of course, if we're going to compare what's happened now to what happened in the past, you've got to realise that in the past, the terrorism of the Brigata Rossa in Italy, of the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the right-wing terrorists, and other groups were all orchestrated by the intelligence services. And we know for a fact that the Western intelligence services, including MIT in Turkey, were part of NATO, working with the Qatari and the Saudi intelligence services to set up terrorist cells inside Syria. The British SAS were in Syria last week when the Russians bombed a base which they'd been operating in with a particular group. They'd only left some hours before. The evidence suggests that all of these jihadis that have been going into Syria, and we're talking about thousands and thousands of them, have been doing so with the help and encouragement of the intelligence services. At the same time, as the media are telling us, like, these people are terrible, we're at war with them, blah, 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 but Assad must go, and the only way to get rid of him is for these people
to kick him out. Some of the patterns that have been going on with these attacks. First of all, most of them are targeting innocent people, that is to say, people who've played no part whatever in any kind of attack on the Middle East by some of these Western countries.
Well, that's quite right. And Vincenzo Vincinguerra, who was a fascist terrorist in Italy, who was eventually caught by the police. And, of course, we know what happened in Italy because the police didn't sit on their hands. They did investigate, and they uncovered the fact that it was the intelligence services who were behind it. And he said, well, the point about it is that we do attack people at random, the general population, because we're trying to terrify people. If you've got people who are suicide bombers, you can carry out hits on hard targets, never mind tube trains and priests.
But this attack wasn't carried out by Vincenzo Vincinguerra, was it?
No, he was involved in the Bologna bombing...
What I will point out, though, is that almost every single case we've had of these, the suspect has been killed by the police.
Well, indeed, because what you do is you set these patsies up. They go out looking for people who've got a Muslim background, but usually, and don't forget, you've got plenty of disaffected youth in places like France who are Muslim origin, but in trouble with the law through drugs
and the guy that ploughed through the people, apparently, with his truck in Nice, wasn't a Muslim at all. He had no actual Muslim connection.
Well, he was of a Muslim extraction, even though he's got no Muslim beliefs.
Middle Eastern, you could call him. Yeah. Certainly not Muslim.
Yeah, but he wasn't a Muslim in the sense of a practising Muslim. But he was from, his family were Muslims, etc. Also, of course, incidentally, the secret police in France have insisted that all video footage of the attack is to be deleted. because they don't want they claim that they don't want other people being radicalised by looking at this footage.
Okay, before we get
but at
off
the same
Normandy,
time, the local police are saying, "Hang on a minute, what do you mean we're going to get rid
before,
of all the footage?"
Before we get off Normandy, there is a tradition, if you want to call it that, it's a pretty hideous tradition of attacks on churches, and there was one in the Coptic Christian Church in Alexandria, wasn't there?
There was.
So it's nothing. It's not as if saying, "Oh, this has never happened before." Actually, that attack on that church in Alexandria turned out to be done by some people from the Interior Ministry.
Indeed.
The central
indeed.
Government in Egypt.
So, in other words, when you see attacks on innocent people or on churches or on things like this, the first question in your mind, given the history that we know of intelligence services like in Egypt and Turkey, Egypt isn't part of NATO, Turkey is, in Italy and France in the past, in Germany in the past. The last bombings in Germany were in Munich in 1980, and they were carried out by the security forces. Now, people have got to realise that in the past, we have overwhelming evidence through police investigation that the Western security forces have engaged in what is known as false flag terrorism. We also know for a fact that NATO and the Gulf countries, including Britain, have been involved in fomenting struggles inside Syria. Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is on the record as saying that he was approached before the war in Syria began by British officials, said, "We're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?" So we've got prima facie evidence, pretty strong evidence, that NATO's been involved in funding, arming and training jihadi groups inside Syria.
Let's not forget about Germany, because doctor died after being shot in a Berlin hospital Tuesday, July the 26th, during the fifth horror attack in Germany in just over a week. A string of violent attacks started when an axe man hacked passengers on a train in Würzburg on Monday, July the 18th. A young Iranian-German-born gunman went on a deadly rampage in Munich on Friday, July the 22nd, after being inspired by far-right killer Anders Breivik.
That's disputed.
In two
that's
separate
disputed.
Attacks, on Sunday, July the 24th, a man blew himself up in Ansbach, and a man killed a pregnant woman during a machete attack in Reutlingen. Now, you can't deny these. That's four different...
No, nobody's denying these things happen. The question is, why are all these different people with very different motivations? Don't forget, this Iranian German is going to be a Shia, not a Sunni, and therefore, if things like this have been...
Well, there is actually some dispute about whether he had any real link to Iran.
Well, indeed. So the fact that you've got these random people who are just carrying out attacks, who haven't got any ostensible political motive, that then fits in the pattern of strategy of tension as well. Because what you do is you just get people absolutely terrified of being attacked by right-wing extremists, left-wing extremists, Islamic extremists, and, of course, all of this is being orchestrated, and therefore you then demand extra powers. We've got to go and bomb Syria more. Although I can't see how bombing Syria more is going to make any difference to a Tunisian no-hoper deciding he's going to drive
on,
a truck.
Then we come
incidentally,
on
of course, the trucks were allowed onto the Corniche because the police had moved the barriers that they used to that were in place an hour before.
Okay.
These are the kind of questions that have to be asked.
Back to the Nice attacks then, and that was the 14th of July. A terrorist in a lorry mowed down revellers who'd just finished watching a firework display to mark Bastille Day. 84 people apparently killed there. The attacker, Mohamed Lahouadj Bouelel, gosh, difficult to pronounce that one, Tunisian-born French citizen, was shot dead by security forces. Martin, you mentioned that the French central government instructed the Nice city council and the mayor to destroy all CCTV footage. Well, now a French officer has claimed the Interior Ministry made her alter her Nice attack report. Her name's Sandra Bertin, and she was in charge of Nice's CCTV control room. She told the Journal de Dimanche newspaper on Sunday an unnamed Interior Ministry official contacted her after the attack and ordered her to alter the report for the night of the incident, basically saying that she'd seen central government police in certain places where they weren't there on the CCTV.
Well, this when you get tensions between local police officers with their democratic accountability and the intelligence services, this is another red flag that we're dealing with potential false flag terror. And of course, what happened in Italy in the end is that the local police forces working with the magistrates carried out their independent investigations, and Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book about all of this. It came out in 2012, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, where he pointed the finger firmly at NATO intelligence services for the bombing of Bologna railway station,
etc. Let's go back to the Brussels bombings. That was March the 22nd, killed 32 people and wounded more than 300 other victims in a day of terror. Two suicide bombings at Brussels airport and another bombing at a metro station in the Belgian capital.
Well, the very least you can say about this is that these jihadists have been encouraged by the Western powers to go to Turkey and to infiltrate into Syria and via Jordan to fight against Assad. And therefore, they have encouraged these very terrorists that then turned around and come back and attack them. So you could say it's blowback. But I think it's worse than that. I think that in actual fact, this is an orchestrated terror campaign by the Western intelligence services. That's pretty much what the Russians have been saying. And of course, they've got their own sources of information that aren't just looking at the internet.
Well, it's not just the Russians saying that. There's actually quite a lot of alternative media around the Western world saying exactly the same, particularly like the Voltaire Network by Thierry Masson, who was one of the first people to call out the 2001 9/11 attacks. Okay, then before that, we had November the 13th, 2015, the Paris attacks, 130 victims killed. Is there anything you point to that, which has kind of transpired since, which we weren't told at the time?
Well, there are loads of anomalies with all of these events. Obviously, the things we know most about are the ones which happen in our own country. So the 7/7 attacks, we've comprehensively looked into
those.
We're
talking about the Paris attacks. The Paris attacks, one of the things I would say is that it certainly looked as if these were done by professional soldiers, not by somebody who was just some kind of fanatic.
Well, the other odd thing is why would the Kouachi brothers go out on a rampage and leave their ID very conveniently in a car and so that they can then be identified and assassinated?
And one thing that
would you do that if you were a terrorist?
Pointing to as the start of this was January the 7th last year. That's the Charlie Hebdo attack. Anything you'd like to point out about that?
Well, I'm just talking about the Kouachi brothers who were blamed for it and then murdered. But they left, apparently, supposedly, left their ID in the getaway car, as you would. You know, you'd go off to an assault like that, carrying your ID, and then you take it out of your pocket and put it in the car seat as you ran away
also,
from the car.
One of the things about
that's
that
the obvious
is,
thing you'd
is
do.
That the police guard that was supposed to be there and was there every day for some reason wasn't there.
Yep, all of these things tend to suggest that these are false flag attacks. You can never be sure because, especially when an event has just happened, what's got to be absolutely clear is we condemn these attacks. There is no excuse for them. The idea that Tony Blair's attack on Iraq is some kind of excuse for them. Tony Blair shouldn't have attacked Iraq. It was all evil, should never have happened. But nobody should think that gives any justification for any attack of this sort. And when MI5 said, as we're told, they said that, Tony Blair, we warned him that there would be more attacks if he attacked Iraq. I just don't think that's a legitimate line of inquiry. These attacks are wrong, whoever carried them out. But we suspect that the intelligence services are the true masterminds.
Now, what can we learn from the Operation Gladio attacks, mostly during the 1980s? Because these were particular points where European governments weren't doing what the Pentagon wanted.
Well, indeed. So people can look this up. They just do a basic web search for Gladio, and they will find, for example, the three films made by BBC Two, for Frankovich by BBC Two, which came out in 1993, exposing all of this. I mean, most people in Britain simply do not understand that the Western intelligence services created Al-Qaeda and then claimed to lose control of it, although they still seem to be directing it. I mean, Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda, Syria, the Russians were trying to bomb them the other day, and the Americans saying, "Oh, don't bomb them; they're moderates." Now that's because they've been armed and trained by the Americans. So and General Petraeus, who used to be in charge in Afghanistan, openly said, "Well, we ought to support Al-Nusra Front in Syria, even though they're Al-Qaeda, because they're against Assad." And in actual fact, he's just saying what's already been happening. Most people out there, you know, the knowledgeable, the Syrian army, the Russian army, the Iranian army, they know Hezbollah, they know that the extremist jihadis, Sunni jihadis, are virtually all run from Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Washington and London. It's just something that everybody knows. And this is going to become clear now if Turkey decides to drop these people. It may be that Turkey's going to leave NATO as a result of this attempted coup against Erdogan. And in that case, they will probably drop a lot of these. That will be the deal with Assad. That we will drop
another
supporting
piece of
these
news
people.
That's come out this week is that the battalions that were involved in the coup 2 weeks ago, they seem to be. I mean, this is what certainly I've been reading online, several different sources, is that they were part of the NATO Rapid Reaction Force, the Turkish contingent of
indeed.
The
well,
NATO
every
forces.
Every military coup in Turkey from 1950 onwards, and they've had four or five, has been run from the United States and Britain. So why would this one be any different?
Anyway, back to Gladio. Sybil Edmonds has talked about what's going on in Europe. She's a former CIA whistleblower,
FBI
whistleblower, as Gladio 2. What does she mean by that?
Well, she just means Gladio. Gladio ultimately was investigations in the Italian Parliament, the Belgian Parliament, and the Swiss Parliament. And for those who were paying attention, there was an acceptance that in actual fact, yes, the intelligence services had been behind the terrorism. And then people presume that with the fall of the Soviet Union, this kind of extreme anti-communist manipulation was over. And and of course, we did support Al Qaeda in the 1980s to fight Russians in Afghanistan. The SAS them in Scotland and so on, for example, but that was all over because the Russians were no longer the enemy, and therefore that nothing happened after that. I would suggest that that is simply wrong, that in actual fact jihadi terrorism has been a tool of Western intelligence services since the 1980s when the Safari Club was set up by the French intelligence services. All of these things are checkable. Don't take our word for it. Go and do your own research, and you will see that in actual fact there's a pattern here, and the pattern is NATO intelligence services engaging in false flag terror.
You could actually look at the Gladio attacks back in the 1980s, mostly in Italy, but also, for example, the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany. There was the Beer Fest
Dortmund Beer Hall Massacre.
Oktoberfest, that's the one. Killing. Munich, I think that was. And also in Belgium too. That was in a way a kind of rehearsal for what's happening today.
Well, in those days, people were shocked by terrorism. They were thinking, it had a shocking effect. The Bologna bomb in particular in Italy had the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the prime minister, had a shocking effect. It undermined the Italian Communist Party, etc. The Belgians, after their supermarket massacres, did allow cruise missiles on their soil, even though the socialist government didn't want them. The message got through. But I think that what's happened is because of the relative success of their previous outings, the intelligence services of the West, including the Israelis, have got more and more determined to carry out this kind
now,
of assault
look
on,
at
our,
the,
on all of us.
The two of these recent attacks, we've had a German attack in Munich, we've had the Brussels attack in Brussels, of course, which is the headquarters of NATO. No commentary at all that the last attacks in those cities were actually done by NATO. Everyone seems to have forgotten what happened in the 80s.
Well, we haven't, and those who are paying attention will know that don't forget that Muhlenbeek, where these so-called terrorists came from, is right next door to SHAPE headquarters, which is where all Gladio was run from in the 70s and the 80s. Look at the kind of people that are supposedly carrying out these attacks. They are largely people with mental health issues, problems with the law, and problems with petty crime and drugs. I would put it to you that these are not typical hardcore terrorists, not by any stretch of the imagination. They're not the kind of people that used to join the Provisional IRA. They're not even the kind of people that used to join things like the Red Brigades, although they were eventually infiltrated.
And the targets are actually counterproductive to their cause. Not only that, but they're then killed, so they can't give any evidence.
Well, indeed. And what happens is there's a chap, James Howell, in the US, as you're probably aware, who's handed himself into the police, saying that he was being trained along with Sadiq Mateen, the guy who supposedly carried out the Orlando attack at a CIA training camp. Now, we know that this has been going on, and I think what's been happening in Syria, in particular over the last 4 years, it's right up to date. The Western powers have been arming, training, directing and sending people into Syria to fight the Assad government. They've been doing that pretty openly in Jordan and in Turkey. And then when these people then turn up in Brussels starting to bomb and shoot and kill, is anybody that surprised? That is what, you know, it's not even disputable. And the Syrian government has said this all along. Why is it evil when this guy comes and kills a priest in Normandy, but when loads of priests have been killed in Syria by the same people, you cheer them on and provide them with weaponry?
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. Leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
We cross the Atlantic now, Martin. It's been the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention last week. Big scandal, though, over apparent hacking of Hillary Clinton's email by the Russians.
It wasn't by the Russians. It's probably somebody.
How do you know?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, the fact is somebody leaked it. What the emails show is that basically Bernie Sanders was had the nomination stolen from him, and that in actual fact there was a massive voter fraud in places like California. And also, of course, virtually half the delegates at the Democratic National Convention walked out because they said it was a stitch-up, but that wasn't shown on national media in the US.
Or here. Pretty much. I mean, I think this is
extraordinary.
It just shows how totally non-democratic the US is. They put a kind of candidate that no one's going to vote for as Hillary Clinton. It's completely
Well, they
tainted.
Don't even report the fact that half the people walk out, which you'd have thought that journalists would report that just
anyway,
as a fact, wouldn't
Democracy
you?
Now had a chat to Julian Assange about all this because he was the source of the leaks, apparently not the Russians.
Just before we went to air, a CNN poll came out that says Donald Trump is ahead by 5 percentage points of Hillary Clinton. Now, he did just come off of the Republican convention.
Well, you're asking me, do I prefer cholera or gonorrhea? Personally, I would prefer neither. We know how politics works in the United States. Whatever political party gets into government is going to merge with the bureaucracy pretty damn fast. Corporate lobbyists will move in to help to control those levers. So it doesn't make much difference in the end. What does make a difference is political accountability, a general deterrence set to stop political organizations behaving in a corrupt manner. That can make a difference because that changes the perception of what you can do or not do. And so top emails, this instruction by Louis Miranda, the head of communications, to go out and covertly spread anti-Bernie Sanders propaganda is a clear instruction combined with a chain of command. It's not simply expressing a sentiment. It is expressing an instruction within the DNC to subvert the Bernie Sanders campaign. Then there's a lot of emails about the close relationship between the DNC and the media. The Washington Post involved in a co-fundraising party, an off-list co-fundraising party for the DNC, calling up MSNBC during the middle of a program and saying, pull that segment now. Debbie Wasserman Schultz calling up the president of MSNBC in order to discipline Morning Joe, etc. That's, you know, of course, something that we've all suspected happens, but this is concrete proof of it.
Well, still banged up inside the Ecuadorian embassy, Julian Assange there, really probably the most important investigative journalist on the planet. But the incredible leaks, the devastating leaks, are just not being reported, Martin.
Well, they're only being reported, the spin being put on it by the Clinton campaign is that it was the Russians who hacked the DNC, and that they're wanting Trump to win because Trump's more pro-Putin, etc. The Russians have denied it. I'm sure that they could hack these things if they wanted
to. There's been no evidence.
But I very much doubt, and they may have done so, but I doubt very much that they'd use it to try and intervene in the election
campaign.
Martin,
there's been no evidence that the Russians did, but you probably wouldn't expect evidence. One thing that The Intercept has pointed out, which is a brilliant website, Glenn Greenwald and various other people on there, is that there would be evidence if the Russians had, the NSA would know, and they could present the evidence to the public that the Russians had done it,
but
they haven't.
They could. It's more likely that it's a disgruntled insider, and incidentally, somebody who was in charge of communication for the DNC has been assassinated. The police are treating it as a robbery, even though his wallet wasn't and his phone weren't taken. It could be somebody like him that's leaked it, because they're so horrified by the fact that Sanders was cheated of the nomination. And he was cheated of the nomination without the superdelegates. And if the primaries had been conducted correctly, he would be the candidate to take on Donald Trump. And in actual fact, in my view, somebody much more likely to beat him than Hillary Clinton.
Great article this week from Dmitry Orlov, I'd not come across before, on Information Clearinghouse. He says the way things are supposed to work on this planet is like this. The US, the power structures, public and private, decide what they want the rest of the world to do. They communicate their wishes through official and unofficial channels, expecting automatic cooperation. If cooperation is not immediately forthcoming, they apply political, financial and economic pressure. If that still doesn't produce the intended effect, they attempt regime change through a colour revolution or a military coup, or organise and finance an insurgency leading to terrorist attacks and a civil war in the recalcitrant nation. If that still doesn't work, they bomb the country back to the Stone Age. That's the way it's worked in the 1990s and the 2000s, but as of late, a new dynamic has emerged. The power of Niet is the title of the article, and it's really referring to the Russians, saying we're not having any more of this.
Well, that's right. I think Orlov actually was a dissident who escaped from, correct me if I'm wrong, but he actually went to the US and he wrote a book about the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then he compared the current US situation to being like the Soviet Union, that it's going to collapse for similar reasons. It's top heavy, it's manipulated, it's not a free or sustainable system.
And Brazil, of course, has become one of the victims recently of that.
It has. We've had a soft coup in Brazil where Rousseff has been removed, even though she won the election 2 years ago. And people more satisfactory to the oligarchy in the United States and the local oligarchy in Brazil have been imposed, even though they're much, much more heavily involved in corruption than Rousseff. All they could come up against Rousseff, who had been tortured by the military dictatorship as a 20-something, was that she'd lied about the national debt in order to, and covered up the national debt
being
more...
You mean like George Osborne?
Just like George
Osborne, every other chancellor.
Meanwhile, the people that have removed her have been lying about their own personal finances, but that's apparently okay. I mean, there is an offensive going on across the planet by the oligarchy in the United States to try and retain hegemony over the international system.
Anyway, Brazil is where everyone's eyes are going to be looking. I mean, it starts in about a week and a half, I think, maybe a week and a bit, when they have the opening ceremony of the Rio Olympics. So let's have a close look at that tonight. I know there's two people across the planet, I think, are the most trustworthy commentators. One of them is the journalist who was part of the revelations about Edward Snowden, and did a lot of the work on that. That's Glenn Greenwald. So let's hear from him now. And he was talking again to Democracy Now!
Being here in Brazil, where a majority of the country actually was born into a military dictatorship, one that overthrew the democratically elected government in 1964 and then proceeded to impose military rule on the country for the next 21 years, very brutal and oppressive military rule. I'm living in a country here that's actually a very young and therefore fragile democracy, although it's become this kind of inspiring model for the world. It has really thrived. It has made extremely impressive strides in terms of lifting people out of poverty and giving them opportunity and creating mature democratic institutions. And to sit here and witness the utter dismantling of a democracy, which is exactly what is taking place, by the richest and most powerful people in the society, using their media organs that masquerade as journalistic outlets, but are which in fact propaganda channels for a tiny number of extremely rich families, almost all of whom supported that coup and then the military dictatorship. The realization is starting to sink in that what this really is about is two things. One, installing as president and the controlling faction in Brasilia, a group of people who believe in very pro-business, neoliberal ideology that want to dismantle core social programs that have been constructed over the last 20 years and which on its own could never be accepted by the majority of Brazilian voters. And secondly, what it's about is empowering the very people in Brasilia who actually are corrupt, who actually have stolen money, huge amounts of money, and squandered it away in foreign bank accounts and used it to buy second and third and fourth homes in the names of other people, the actually corrupt thieves in Brasilia. It's about empowering them so they can protect themselves and kill the corruption investigation. And once people really start to focus on that, as they're doing now, you're starting to see civil disobedience, instability, increasingly violent protests. The real question is going to become, how is the population of this country going to react when they realize that democracy has been taken out of their hands? This combination, this really toxic combination of ideology and self-interest, combined with what I cannot emphasize enough is the central role of Brazil's oligarchical media in inciting and inflaming all of this, in not allowing a plurality of opinion to be heard, in this relentless parade of pro-opposition propaganda.
That's Brazil-based U.S. journalist Glenn Greenwald.
Yeah, well, I mean, Brazil has been a success story for many years when the Partido de Trabalhadores, the Workers' Party, took power under Lula da Silva and then Dilma Rousseff as his protege. Ordinary poor people in Brazil have seen a big improvement in their living standards and conditions. Still a pretty miserable place to be poor, but it was better than it was. But, of course, now this is all about to be smashed and they're going back to where they were before.
Yeah. The other really good writer on Brazil is Pepe Escobar. He's, I think, also Brazilian. And this is what he had to say on RT's Crosstalk.
It is a coup. It's been in gestation since Dilma Rousseff won her re-election in late 2014. The project, if we can call it that, is a perfect alignment in Brazil of the executive, the legislative, the judiciary, and powerful media interests, the offensive against the BRICS as a whole. This is part of full-spectrum dominance, the official Pentagon doctrine of 2002. The hybrid war element, they are fine-tuning hybrid war tools depending on each situation. So yeah. You have a mechanism for Ukraine. You have a mechanism against Russia directly, internally in Russia. Yeah. You have a mechanism in the Middle East, especially Syria. And you have a mechanism specially developed for Brazil, which started with the NSA hack of Petrobras. This was leaked then to a provincial judge in a very conservative southern state in Brazil, who one day from another, he had absolutely priceless information, knowing everything that was going on inside Petrobras. By himself, he will never have access to that kind of information. So this developed into a mix. The first phase of the hybrid war would be, okay, let's try to do a regime change soft or light, which is what we are now. We are the first stage, second stage Senate, third stage the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court in Brazil is also extremely compromised. They don't have the guts or the balls to go against the legislative. So what I spoke at the beginning of the program, the ideal project for this neoliberal restoration is a perfect alignment of the three powers plus media corporate interests, which in Brazil is basically four families. And I know these absolute rascals from the inside because I wrote for their newspapers many, many, many eons ago. Okay. So I can talk with direct experience.
I'm sure you can. Let me go.
And how they are pro-military dictatorship in 1964. Yeah. I was 10 years old at the time, and I remember what happened, and now they want to do the same thing.
Brazilian journalist Pepe Escobar has got a column at the Asia Times, Martin.
Yeah, and he mentioned the term hybrid war there. Andrew Karibko uses this term as well, if people want to look him up. Hybrid war is the Western oligarchy's attempt to control the world's politics by a number of different methods. It involves colour revolutions, so you're persuading young people to go into the streets and rebel against things if they don't like the government concerned. It can involve political assassination. It can involve scandals about corruption. It can involve sex scandals like the removal of the head of the IMF... Remember the...
It can involve...
That.
Both of them seem to... Yeah,
It can involve false flag terrorism, like 9/11 and the things we were talking about in Gladio, we were talking about earlier. The oligarchy is the ultimate source of terrorism. And if you think about who they are the Bush family and the Saudis and all the rest of it. These people are terrorists, frankly.
So what about the risks at the Games? Because we were involved, weren't we, 4 years ago in the run-up to the London Olympics in making sure that Shimon Peres and the Israelis didn't have their own little compound inside the Olympic Park where they could do what they wanted. The army stopped that, and then Shimon Peres never came to the Olympics. But also G4S were in charge, and they realised the organisers, with about 2 weeks to go, that G4S didn't know what on earth they were doing, and they had to bring, I think it was altogether, 5,000 soldiers in to do their job for them at the last minute.
Well, it may be that there was going to be some false flag attack on the Olympic Games to be blamed on the Iranians, with G4S as the vehicle. That's what's possible there.
What about Rio, though? What are the risks, do you think?
Well, because Rousseff has been removed, I would suggest that there's less likelihood of an attack, because the game is going according to plan from the oligarchy's point of view.
The thing is, though, in order to do an attack, the cover-up, you have to make sure that you're controlling the various institutions to do the cover-up, and maybe Rousseff wouldn't have gone along with that.
She might not, that's true. It's hard to say, but when an incident happens, we must analyse it objectively. And the likelihood is that virtually all international terrorism involving international personalities, people who cross borders, virtually all of that is orchestrated by somebody's intelligence services.
BCFM. Now, capitalism died in 2008, and our economics are only being kept alive with massive injections of QE, printing money. Wages and employment are stalling. With work no longer a route out of poverty here in Britain, millions of us have become the victims of a hidden kind of economic warfare by our government. So let's have a listen now to William Cooper with his reading of this document called Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, the idea being that everybody can be registered as an economic unit, and then if they're doing what the system wants, they're rewarded with more money. If they're not, money's taken away.
Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. An introductory programming manual, operations research technical manual, TM-SW7905.1. Silent weapon technology has evolved from operations research, ROR, a strategy and tactical methodology developed under the military management in England during World War II. The original purpose of operations research was to study the strategic and tactical problems of air and land defense with the objective of effective use of limited military resources against foreign enemies. In other words, folks, logistics. For after they developed this operations research and found out that it could be extremely useful, it was soon recognized by those in positions of power that the same methods might be useful for totally controlling a society. But better tools at that time were necessary. Social engineering, folks, the analysis and automation of a society, requires the correlation of great amounts of constantly changing economic information or data. So a high-speed, computerized data processing system was necessary, which could race ahead of the society and predict when society would arrive for capitulation. Relay computers were too slow, but the electronic computer invented in 1946 by J. Presper Eckert and John W. Mauchly filled the bill. The next breakthrough was the development of the simplex method of linear programming in 1947 by the mathematician George B. Danzig. Then, in 1948, the transistor, invented by J. Bardeen, W. H. Brattain, and W. Shockley, promised great expansion of the computer field by reducing space and power requirements. With these three inventions, under their direction, Those in positions of power strongly suspected that it was possible for them to control the whole world with the push of a button. Immediately, the Rockefeller Foundation got in on the ground floor by making a 4-year grant to Harvard College, funding the Harvard Economic Research Project for the study of the structure of the American economy. 1 year later, folks, in 1949, the United States Air Force joined in. In 1952, the original grant period terminated, and a high-level meeting of the elite was held to determine the next phase of social operations research. The Harvard Project had been very fruitful, as is borne out by the publication of some of its results in 1953, suggesting the feasibility of economic or social engineering. And this was published in a book called Studies in the Structure of the American Economy, copyright 1953, by Wassily Leontief, International Sciences Press, Incorporated, White Plains, New York. I suggest you get it and read it. Engineered in the last half of the decade of the 1940s, the new quiet war machine stood, so to speak, in sparkling gold-plated hardware on the showroom floor by 1954. With the creation of the Maser in 1954, the promise of unlocking unlimited sources of fusion atomic energy from the heavy hydrogen in seawater and the consequent availability of unlimited social power was a possibility only decades away. The combination, of course, was irresistible. The Quiet War was quietly declared by the international elite at a meeting held in 1954, and the name of that group, folks, is the Bilderberg Group. Although the silent weapons system was nearly exposed 13 years later, the evolution of the new weapons system has never, ever suffered any major setbacks, because no one has ever identified that what is happening to them is being caused by any kind of a weapon system at all. In 1954, it was well recognized by those in positions of authority that it was only a matter of time. Only a few decades, folks, before the general public would be able to grasp and upset the cradle of power, for the very elements of the new silent weapon technology were as accessible for a public utopia as they were for providing a private utopia. The issue of primary concern, that of dominance, revolved around the subject of the energy sciences. You see, folks, energy is recognized as the key to all activity on Earth. Natural science is the study of the sources and control of natural energy. And social science, theoretically expressed as economics, is the study of the sources and control of social energy, or society, as a whole. Both, of course, are bookkeeping systems, mathematics. Therefore, mathematics is the primary energy science, and the bookkeeper can be king if the public can be kept ignorant of the methodology of the bookkeeping. You see, folks, all science is merely a means to an end. The means is knowledge. The end is control. And those in power believe that the end always justifies the means. And beyond this remains only one issue, folks. Who will be the beneficiary? In 1954, this was the issue of primary concern. Although the so-called moral issues were raised, in view of the law of natural selection, it was agreed that a nation or world of people who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent, always have been and always will be. Consequently, In the interest of future world order, peace, and tranquility, it was decided to privately wage a quiet war against the American public with an ultimate objective of permanently shifting the natural and social energy, our wealth, of the undisciplined and irresponsible many into the hands of the self-disciplined, responsible, and worthy few. In order to implement this objective, it was necessary to create, secure, and apply new weapons, which, as it turned out, were a class of weapons so subtle and sophisticated in their principle of operation and public appearance as to earn for themselves the name silent weapons. And it was quickly realized that if it was done properly, the public themselves would load the weapons and fire them for the end result of their own destruction. In conclusion, the objective of economic research as conducted by the magnates of capital, or banking, and the industries of commodities, or goods and services, is the establishment of an economy which is totally predictable and manipulatable. Folks, in order to achieve a totally predictable economy, the low-class elements of the society must be brought under total control, in effect, must be housebroken, trained, and assigned a yoke and long-term social duties from a very early age, before they have an opportunity to question the propriety of the matter. In order to achieve such conformity, the lower class family unit must be disintegrated by a process of increasing preoccupation of the parents and the establishment of government-operated daycare centers for the occupationally orphaned children. The quality of education given to the lower class must be of the poorest sort, so that the moat of ignorance isolating the inferior class from the superior class is and remains incomprehensible to the inferior class. With such an initial handicap, even bright lower class individuals have little, if any, hope of extricating themselves from their assigned lot in life. This form of slavery, and slavery it is, to be sure, is essential to maintaining some measure of social order, peace, and tranquility for the ruling upper class. Everything that is expected from an ordinary weapon is expected from a silent weapon by its creators, but only in its own manner of junctioning. It shoots situations instead of bullets, propelled by data processing instead of a chemical reaction or explosion originating from bits of data instead of grains of gunpowder and from a computer instead of a gun, operated by a computer programmer instead of a marksman, under the orders of a banking magnate instead of a military general. It makes no obvious explosive noises, causes no obvious physical or mental injuries, and does not obviously interfere with anyone's daily social life. Yet it makes an unmistakable noise, causes unmistakable physical and mental damage, and unmistakably interferes with daily social life. In effect, unmistakable to a trained observer, one who knows what to look for. The public cannot comprehend this weapon and therefore cannot believe that they are being attacked and subdued by a weapon. The public might instinctively feel that something is wrong, but because of the technical nature of the silent weapon, they cannot express their feeling in a rational way or handle the problem with intelligence. Therefore, they do not know how to cry for help and do not know how to associate with others to defend themselves against it. Dear listeners, when a silent weapon is applied gradually, the public adjusts, adapts to its presence, and learns to tolerate its encroachment on their lives until the pressure, psychological via economic, becomes too great and they just simply crack up. Therefore, the silent weapon is a type of biological warfare. It attacks the vitality, options, and mobility of the individuals of a society by knowing, understanding, manipulating, and attacking their sources of natural and social energy and their physical, mental, and emotional strengths and weaknesses. I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to The Hour of the Time.
Well, I'm Tony Gosling, and you're listening to The Politics Show. That was a clip from the 1990s from Bill Cooper reading out that document, Martin, and we're not saying guaranteeing in any way that it's a genuine document, but it's an interesting idea, isn't it? The idea of social engineering through economics, as particularly when you get the idea of surveillance mixed with of everybody, literally massive amounts of surveillance and big databases and profiling of everybody, it becomes possible, doesn't it, to manage a society using economics. One of the things he was saying there, which I don't know if you'd like, is this idea of the occupationally orphaned children. So the both parents are working, and so the children have to be handed over to the state to look after them from a very, very early age.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest with you, that doesn't happen in the United States. There's hardly any. What happens is that the parents are disempowered through working too hard, through being denied work and turned into drug addicts.
It does happen in Europe, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but I think the idea that Finnish nursery schools are part of the New World Order plot is exaggerated. The real problem is that it's not just mind control. We've been talking about false flag terrorism here. The 9/11 attacks were carried out by the intelligence services. That's 3,000 people dead. And then people worry about being brainwashed. They worry about being microchipped. You should worry about being killed, because that's what goes on. And in Colombia, the people of social movement activists are killed every day. It's just what happens.
They certainly
are. That's social control.
Anyway, I promised you a clip from Fritz Springmeier and Bloodlines of the Illuminati. Worth pointing out that the Queen and her hideous amounts of wealth, she's from the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family, who were very much involved in protecting the Illuminati over in Germany in the late 1700s when the authorities were trying to prosecute them over there. But here he is, and he actually, our very own John Cabot gets a mention, Fritz Springmeier.
The misunderstanding that's common out there is that this man, Adam Weishaupt, which was a pseudonym, a name that he had taken actually, started the Illuminati. He did create a modern structure for it. He was paid by these families to create a modern structure. But he didn't originate the Illuminati. The Illuminati goes back thousands of years before him. And the reason why I mention this is that if we go back into antiquity, we will see that there were certain families that were deified as gods, like Pharaoh, Alexander the Great. Maybe some of the viewers don't know that Alexander the Great believed that he was descended from gods. Genghis Khan, who's still worshipped in Mongolia. These powerful families believed they were gods, and they controlled through their priesthoods in these mystery religions the people that were subservient to them. They never wanted to relinquish power. They networked together. And over history, you can never find any point in history where they gave up their power. What they did is they did a lot of sleight of hands and went underground or behind the scenes and let other people become front men, but they've still stayed in power. You can see a lot of, I give a lot of evidence of that in my Bloodlines of the Illuminati book. Just some everyday examples that I ran into is, as a boy, you know, I met Henry Cabot Lodge. And someone who would read American history would know about John Cabot exploring the United States, which was of the Italian Caboto family. This is an ancient family, and yet you can see their influence in history all down through the years. Recently there was a book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Well, I say recent, it's not been recent, but it became a bestseller, and then the authors made a trilogy of books, Messianic Legacy and The Temple and the Lodge, and
Pageant and Lay and Lincoln were the authors of that trilogy of books. And they go in and discuss how all of the royalty and aristocrats of Europe are descended from one single bloodline. Now, of course, then when you go to look at our presidents, you find that 11 of our presidents, at least 11, are part of that bloodline.
At least 11 presidents are descendants from European royalty.
The Merovingian dynasty. At least.
That's Fritz Springmeier there. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next, a gap in the schedule. We're online, by the way, at thisweek.org.uk, where you can download the podcast. We've got plenty of links up there. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us next week. Don't let the banksters get you down.
Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest with Peter Phillips. Here's what's coming up on today's program. We begin with a discussion on the 28 pages, that recently declassified material about Saudi government connections with the September 11th hijackers. Then for the rest of the hour, we'll learn about a new September 11th documentary, Incontrovertible, and hear from its producer. Please stay tuned. And again, welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest in the KPFA studio with Peter Phillips on the phone from the North Bay. Mickey Huff will be back soon. Today on the program, we'll hear excerpts from the new September 11th documentary, Incontrovertible, and listen to an interview that Peter and I did with Tony Rook, the producer of Incontrovertible. But first, we'll look at the implications of the 28 pages, those newly declassified documents, looking at Saudi government connections with the September 11th hijackers. Our guest for this segment of the show is John Gold, and here's Peter to introduce John.
John Gold has been an advocate for 9/11 justice for over 12 years. He's a member of the steering committee for the 911truth.org and helped found the site 911blogger.com. He's worked with different 9/11 family members for many years, and he helped with the film 9/11 Press for Truth. He has written several articles over the years having to do with 9/11 and authored a book called 9/11 Truther, The Fight for Peace, Justice, and Accountability. John, welcome.
Hi, Peter. How are you today?
Oh, it's cold and foggy up here, but we're glad to have you on. 14 years now, the 28 pages were censored, locked out from public viewing, and now that's come forward, and it's pretty clear that some Saudis had involvement in 9/11. What is the significance of the release of these pages?
Okay, well, what I'll do is I wrote down some notes, and I'll go through them because we don't have a lot of time. If JASTA passes, it will allow the 9/11 family members to take Saudi Arabia to court. If and when that happens, they could use the 28 pages as evidence. Personally, if they take Saudi Arabia to court, I would like to see people like Mike Jacobson, Raj Day, and Dana Lieseman call to testify about their experiences with Philip Zelikow during the 9/11 commission, and then call Philip Zelikow himself to testify. I think that would be interesting, and just so everyone knows, they are the researchers from the 9/11 Commission that worked on the Saudi angle, And Philip Zelikow was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. He was in charge of everything and made sure the 9/11 report did not mention Saudi support for the hijackers. Now, the pages have recently been released, but they still had redactions. Also, on top of the 28 redacted pages, just so everybody knows, there are many documents that still need to be released or unredacted. Right now, there's 80,000 documents pertaining to the Sarasota 9/11 incident that need to be released. Much of the documentation from the 9/11 Commission has yet to be released. Bush's presidential daily briefings, or PDBs, prior to 9/11, and a lot of the documentation from the 9/11 Commission have yet to be released. And many of the pages that were released from the 9/11 Commission have redactions with them as well. The 28 pages basically confirmed and expanded on what we've known for years. They confirmed that Princess Haifa, Prince Bandar's wife, sent money to Osama bin Laden's wife, but it expanded on that information by telling us that Bandar himself sent money directly to Osama bin Laden, a supposed Saudi asset. And the money sent supposedly went to help two of the hijackers, Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi in San Diego. So think about that. The president's friend, otherwise known as Bandar Bush, I believe that is the big story, that Bush protected someone involved in the 9/11 attacks. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so.
John, this is Anthony Fest. Remind our listeners, please, what position Bandar held at that time.
He was the U.S. ambassador from Saudi Arabia. And I found an entry at historycommons.org that I think is interesting, and I don't think that's got much attention. The entry is called March 15th, 2001, Bush tells Saudi prince that military action in Iraq needs to be decisive. And during a meeting with President Bush, Saudi Prince Bandar expresses concern about the U.S.'s continuing patrolling of the no-fly zone in Iraq. The prince complains that it is, quote, costing us militarily, financially, but much more importantly, politically, end quote, and adds that, quote, it is not hurting Saddam Hussein, end quote. Bush seems to agree. Quote, if there is any military action, then it has to be decisive that can finalize the issue, end quote, Bush says. And then, quote, the Iraqi opposition is useless and not effective, end quote. And that's from James Risen's book, State of War. So the president, who wants to go to war with Iraq, is talking about military action in Iraq with someone involved in 9/11, before 9/11. 9/11 was the event that enabled Bush to invade Iraq. I find that to be extremely suspicious, to say the least, especially when you take into account that during the time the 9/11 Commission was questioning Bush and Cheney behind closed doors, not under oath, with no transcripts, 9/11 Commissioner John Lehman asked him specifically about Bandar's connections to 9/11, and Bush, quote, dodged the questions, end quote. You know, if there's nothing to the allegations regarding Bandar and 9/11, then why did Bush feel the need to dodge the questions about it? Also, take into account that Bandar is familiar with how the terrorist system works. He was just responsible for sending in rebels into Syria. Rebels or terrorists, whatever you want to call them.
John, the three of the commissioners from the 9/11 Commission report, John Lehman, Bob Kerry, and Tim Romer, have all acknowledged now that the Saudis were not adequately investigated by the 9/11 Commission. So this opens up a whole can of worms relative to 9/11 in that we don't have the full story yet, which what 9/11 truth people have been saying for 15 years now. And you and many others have just been asking for transparency and full investigation. And this seemed to have been blocked by Zelikow during the 9/11 Commission report.
Yep, absolutely. Philip Zelikow blocked half of the interview requests for Saudi investigators. He made it difficult for the Saudi investigators to gain access to the 28 redacted pages. That caused Dana Lieseman to go through a back channel to gain access to the 28 pages so she could do her job. And Philip Zelikow fired her for it. Philip Zelikow and Dieter Snell, who is someone else on the 9/11 Commission, they took part in a, quote, late-night editing session, end quote, to remove Saudi support from the 9/11 report against the wishes of the Saudi investigators from the 9/11 Commission. And they moved it into footnotes in the back of the book. There's something called an MFR from the 9/11 Commission, which is a memoranda for the record, and it basically explains what they talked about during their interview with a witness. And Prince Mandar's MFR from the 9/11 Commission is classified. How ridiculous is that?
So the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia provided operational and financial support for the 9/11 hijackers, and essentially the 28 pages tells us that that is what happened.
Yep. And, you know, people point to the 9/11 Commission as having looked into this information, and they simply haven't. They've released a document called Monograph for Terrorist Financing, and they address the issue concerning Princess Haifa, but they don't, and they said there's nothing to it, by the way, which is false. But they don't address the direct payment from Bandar to Osama bin Laden. So they pick and chose what they were going to address. You know, how can you take a commission seriously that doesn't look at all of the information?
Absolutely.
Concluding thought, John, why do you suppose these particular 28 pages were released now, approximately coinciding with the two parties' conventions? Any connection there?
Well, I think the release of the pages during the conventions was meant to take away focus from the pages, but the release of the pages have been coming to a head for a long time now. Senator Bob Graham has been fighting for their release. The families have been fighting for their release. Over time, people like Stephen Lynch and Walter Jones and Thomas Massie jump on the bandwagon to get the pages released. And, you know, Obama promised on two separate occasions, two different family members, that he would have released the pages. So I guess he, you know, tried to stick to his promise, even though he took 8 years to do so. It's just been coming to a head, and I think they were finally released. I mean, 60 Minutes just had a segment on the 28 redacted pages, so that helped with the push for their release.
Do you think we can look forward to release of any more materials in the coming months?
I certainly hope so. There needs to be transparency concerning, you know, 9/11, which was the murder of 2,976 people. It's absurd that anything has been held from the public.
Well, John Gold, thank you very much. You've been active on 9/11 research for many, many years now, and we certainly appreciate you taking the time to be on the Project Censored Show with us.
All right, thank you very much for having me on today, and I hope KPFA raises all the money it needs.
And for listeners who want to take a look at those 28 pages, there's been a website created especially for that information, together with analysis and commentary, and that website is 28pages.org. And remember, we're in the final day of the KPFA Summer Pledge Drive. If you like this discussion we just had, if Project Censored and the other programs on KPFA are important to you, please do your part right now to keep KPFA on the air. You can make a pledge of financial support now by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. KPFA membership begins at a very affordable $25 a year. 1-800-439-5732. And we turn now to a look at the latest documentary about the September 11th attacks. It's titled Incontrovertible, and it was created by British film producer Tony Rook, a former BBC employee. Incontrovertible differs from other September 11th documentaries in a couple of respects. First, its main focus is on the fall of World Trade Center Building 7. Building 7 collapsed in the afternoon of September 11th, like the Twin Towers, except that Building 7 was not hit by an airplane. Second, most of the people interviewed for Incontrovertible are firefighters or police officers, and the documentary is specifically addressed to people in fire services, police departments, or the military. Peter and I spoke last week with Tony Rook, the producer of Incontrovertible. In a moment, we're going to hear part of that interview, in which we also played some brief audio clips from the DVD of Incontrovertible. As you're listening, if you think it's important to have information like this on the radio, if you won't hear this on another station in the Bay Area, or perhaps not another station anywhere in the country, please make a pledge of support now by calling 1-800-439-5732. As you listen to our interview with Tony Rook and the audio clips from Incontrovertible, you might decide you want to have a copy of the complete two-hour DVD. If so, just call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. For a pledge of $100 to KPFA, we'll send you that Incontrovertible DVD film as a thank you gift. 1-800-439-5732. Now let's hear part of that interview that Peter and I did with Incontrovertible's producer, Tony Rook. I'm told now that we have Tony Rook from London. Welcome to the Project Censored show, Tony Rook.
Hi there, how are you doing?
It's now been nearly 15 years since the September 11th attack, so our first question for you is, why do another documentary now? Are there issues that previous works didn't address, or are there materials now that weren't available earlier on?
That's the question I asked myself all the time I was making it. I think anyone who's studied the events of 9/11 will know, once you wake up, trying to communicate it to other people, members of your family, and I've been through this as well, it's very, very difficult. And it struck me a few years back that it's almost a waste of time. The only people who can do something about this are our police, our firefighters, and our military. They're the ones who have been endowed with the power to do anything about this. And so I decided to make a film purely directed at them. It's not made for the public. It's not made for 9/11 truthers. It's not made for anyone who doesn't really have the power to do anything about it. And so it was made for the unions, for our police officers, and for the soldiers who were sent to war on this phony pretext of doing something. So it's really minimalized the target audience, and that was the purpose of the film, and that's why I made it. Not really a 9/11 truth movie in the sense of maybe Loose Change.
Well, tell us, Tony Rook, how do rank-and-file firefighters and police have this power that you credit them with?
Well, for example, Anthony, in the United Kingdom, there are 44,000 members of the Fire Brigade Union in this country, and they, through their membership, have to pay a certain amount of money every week to the Labour Party, which is the shadow government at the moment in the United Kingdom. And it's my hope, and we're having some success. I can't go into it in too much detail because it's ongoing and slightly sensitive, to put it politely, but we're having a lot of success here. A couple of firefighters have seen the film. They've taken it to their trade union leaders here, and it's now got to the higher echelons of the Fire Brigade Union in the United Kingdom, who are taking it extremely seriously, because let's assume that you don't go along with the inside job story. Let's say you believe hook, line, and sinker, the theory given to us by the National Institute of Standards and Technology on this. It represents a real threat for firefighters. They could go into a building, I'm talking about Building 7, by the way, specifically. They could go into a building and this thing could fall down on their heads within 5 hours of normal office fire. So that's a serious threat to them. And under the health and safety regulations of the 1970s in this country, they have to take this very, very seriously. They're legally obliged to look into it. And that's what's happened here. Like I said, I can't go into it in too much detail, but that's something that's happened in the United Kingdom and something that I believe is growing in the United States from the contacts I've had with people over there. So that's the reason the film was made, and that's the effects it's having, or it's beginning to have over here. It's only taken, 15 years, but, what the hell? It's worth a try, isn't it?
Tony Rook, you certainly in the film lead us and expect us to understand that Building 7 and likely Towers 1 and 2 were brought down by controlled demolition. Nonetheless, you are saying here that if they weren't, if the government's hypothesis is correct, that there's still a major problem. That a fire, certainly in Building 7, collapses the building, according to NISC, with just office fire. And had they not evacuated the building, they could well have been many hundreds of firefighters in there fighting this fire, and this building collapses on top of them. So that contradiction seems to be one of your main points. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We don't concentrate in the film on the Twin Towers too much. It is mentioned, but we tend to leave it. Building 7, I think, is for the newbie, and it is a film made for newbies. I mean, a lot of people who listen to your show will be very aware of the evidence surrounding the events of 9/11. This is purely made for firefighters, police officers, soldiers who will be new to this. They won't have seen Loose Change. They won't have seen Press for Truth. They won't have seen In Plain Sight or the myriad movies that have been made about 9/11. So Building 7, to my mind, having studied this stuff for quite a long time, is, to quote Richard Gage, the smoking gun of 9/11 is the most glaringly obvious piece of evidence that I could concentrate on, and so we've stuck with that. And so, yeah, the official story by NIST is that that building fell down purely because of office fires. Now, if that's the case, that is a genuine threat to firefighters. A genuine threat. And under UK law, and I'm sure it's the same in the US, this has to be reported as a health and safety threat, not only to firefighters, but to any emergency worker who's in the vicinity of a high-rise fire, anyone who works in an office. You know, it kind of renders every demolition company in the world almost redundant. You know, don't bother planting explosives, just set off a few office fires and it will come down in 7 hours. So, that was the point, and that's why we concentrate on Building 7.
Let's hear a short excerpt from Incontrovertible. This is part of your interview with Rudy Dent. He is a retired New York City firefighter. Let's hear that clip.
I achieved the American dream only to wake up to the American nightmare. It was a tough situation for us all. We lost 343 guys on that day. I retired with 32 years total. You know, they added up part of my military time and my police time. There's no way in the history of history that a steel frame building of that magnitude has ever come down from a few pockets of fire. I knew instinctively, I was suspicious. It just came down. And there's no question that that was a demolition job that anybody with an open mind and common sense cannot deny.
This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest with Peter Phillips, and our topic today is a new September 11th documentary, Incontrovertible, which focuses on the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7. With us on the phone from London is Tony Rook. He wrote, directed, and edited Incontrovertible. And this, for our KPFA listeners, this is a fund drive program. Our fund drive is underway at the moment, the short summer fund drive. If you'd like to contribute to the station, please call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Peter?
Tony Rook, you've made this movie. It's going to be featured at the 9/11 Film Festival September 8th in Oakland, and I think you're going to be out for that. And we're certainly looking forward to see this on the big screen. I watched it this week and was quite impressed with the effort that you put forward here. You also bring other related areas like the assassination of Martin Luther King into the film. And certainly you challenge the morality of the war on terror. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, Peter. I mean, the reason I did it, because the film was, like I said earlier, specifically made for policemen, firefighters, and soldiers. I think when you show somebody, for example, Building 7, if you show it in isolation, any 9/11 material, really, if you're trying to persuade people that it is, for want of a better phrase, an inside job, especially to police officers, to show it out of context, it's a bit much to consume. And let's be honest, I think we all went into shock when we began to realize that 9/11 wasn't as advertised. So if you can show 9/11 in context, meaning that the American government have tried this before, and one of those efforts before, what I would call a false flag event, would be the assassination of Martin Luther King, which, of course, Coretta King took to court in the 1990s, 99 I think it was, and a civil jury looked at the evidence and decided that the American government was guilty of assassinating Martin Luther King in tandem with Lloyd Jowers, of course, not in isolation, but that the American government were complicit in the killing of Martin Luther King. Then that gives a police officer, it gives them a little bit more substance to get their head around and think, well, hang on a minute, you know, 9/11 is not the only thing they've ever tried. And then, of course, earlier on in the film, if you've seen it, it talks about Operation Northwood. I haven't even gone into things like Operation Gladio, which we've had in Europe, but it's trying to put the false flag envelope, if you like, around the events of 9/11 to show that this isn't unusual and it shouldn't be unexpected.
You indeed talk about the bombings in London and other terrorist attacks. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a little known fact that the false flag, what I would call the false flag bombings of July 2005, 7/7/2005, were actually taken to court. What happened was that a gentleman called John Hill, who I know, John's a very nice man, very intelligent chap, made a movie called 7/7 Ripple Effect, which was purely made for the internet. It was a very low-budget film, but it took all the evidence that we have on the 7/7 bombings and laid out the, or for want of a better word, the alternative explanation for what happened that day. And for making a film, he was taken to court. What happened was he sent the movie to a terror trial related to the London bombings. This was after the event of some lads who were accused of plotting terrorist attacks in the capital. And he sent his film 7/7 Ripple Effect, which was about the London bombings, to this trial, to the judge and to the jury. Now, that's called an amicus curiae brief, which means friend of the court. And he was concerned that these boys were going to be fairly tried, that all the evidence was not going to be taken into consideration, and so he sent the film to the court, for which he was extradited from his home in Ireland, put on trial, having spent 150 days in prison, by the way, put on trial in London, facing a potential of 20 years in prison for making a documentary. And they showed the film to a jury, and the jury turned around, watched the film, and said, no, that's fair comment, and you're not guilty of attempting to pervert the course of justice. I don't know what legal terms you would use, Peter, in the United States for this, but a British jury looked at the film, which was basically pointing the finger of guilt at the British government for the London bombings, and said, no, that's fair comment. Away you go. You're not guilty. You're free to walk. And if anyone's seen the film, and I'd urge them to watch it, and it is mentioned in my movie, Incontrovertible, then I'd certainly urge them to take a look at it. The evidence for government complicity in the attacks of 7/7 is very strong, very strong.
Let's hear another excerpt from the documentary we're discussing right now, Incontrovertible. Let's hear from Brian Maxwell. He was formerly a firefighter with the Edinburgh Fire Service.
It's difficult. It's difficult to get people to engage with this subject when there's so much other things going on in the world. Portrayed by the mainstream for that very purpose of distracting people away from serious issues. I've been aware of the problems with the official story for 9/11 since approximately 2010. For a period of time, I was in a state of shock that we had not been told the truth about that event. I was surprised that I hadn't seen Building 7 before. It's not something that's been publicised. There are not many people that know about it. If you want to know about Building 7, you more or less have to go on the internet and research it for yourself. The mainstream media, in my opinion, have towed the line as far as the establishment story is concerned, and they've painted people who are searching for the truth as a bit cuckoo.
And note that we described Brian Maxwell as formerly with the Edinburgh Fire Service, because he found himself out of a job after appearing in Incontrovertible, correct?
Yeah, that's right, sadly. He did. It's a difficult one. He provided me with some stills from his job when he was, you know, posing with his colleagues, as you do at work sometimes. You have photographs taken with your friends. And he was still working for the Edinburgh Fire Service when he made the comments that we just heard. And they turned around and said, no, you can't do that. You are in the employ of the Edinburgh Fire and Rescue Service, and you shouldn't be doing that. But what really got them upset was that Brian then took the finished film, passed it around his colleagues, sent it to police officers, firefighters and soldiers in the Scottish capital, to the degree that the Scottish police department actually got in touch with his fire station and said, look, what the hell is this guy doing? and actually made an assessment on the movie to see if it was a terror threat, which is, of course, ridiculous, because the film is completely full of police officers talking about 9/11, so I'd hardly call it a terror threat. But Brian found himself in this invidious position where he felt he couldn't really speak his mind, you know, in an allegedly free country, and so he resigned. And I think he's actually got a very good case for what we call constructive dismissal in this country, where he was forced to pack in his job. So he's no longer a Scottish firefighter, which is sad, because he was with them for 15 years. And he was very good at his job. He's a wonderful chap.
His freedom of speech didn't extend to the workplace.
Not on this occasion, no. Which is sad and very strange, because in England, there's another, well, I can't name them, but another fire service here has taken the completely opposite view, and they've embraced the film and all the implications in it. And it's now got to national level here. And I can't go much further than that, because it's an ongoing situation, and given how the fire service react to some of this stuff, I don't want to go any further.
And we're back live now on KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, or KFCF in Fresno. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest with Peter Phillips. We've just heard an interview that Peter and I did a week ago with Tony Rook, the producer of Incontrovertible. Incontrovertible is our premium for this hour. Please call 1-800-439-5732 to support the Project Censored Show and KPFA. If you can manage a $100 contribution, you can take a copy of the DVD of Incontrovertible as our thank you gift for your support. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Peter?
You know, that's only about $8 a month, and you can spread that out for a year, but you can, you know, $100 put on a credit card, that's an easy thing to do. And this DVD, 2 hours long, highly documented, the newest thing out on 9/11, will be featured at the 9/11 Film Festival this year in Oakland on September 8th. But we ask you to support KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. Support the Project Censored Show. You can donate online at kpfa.org and pick up this DVD. It's probably the strongest, one of the strongest DVDs on 9/11. Here's a quote from Dave Chandler, a physicist, absolutely first rate. The film manages to navigate the broad aspects of 9/11 with all the complexity and even tie it in with 7/7 and JFK and avoiding the pitfalls of discredited speculative theories. I have no hesitation in sharing this with anyone. That's Dave Chandler. That kind of information is very important now, as hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people worldwide begin to understand that 9/11 was certainly not just 12, you know, the 19 hijackers, and you know, without other help. And so, and even if they were on those planes, which is just, there's no proof of that. These are things that we need to fully expose and have transparent in order to protect ourselves and our society. I think it's really important. So call 1-800-439-5732 right now to pick up this film, Incontrovertible.
Yes, indeed, Peter. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call to make your pledge to KPFA. Today is the final day of our summer pledge drive. We do need your support. 1-800-439-5732. The importance of KPFA, I think, is a spur to thinking. If you look at your average political commercial this election season, you know, it actually encourages you not to think. It just encourages you to react. It perhaps reaches down to the reptile brain rather than the frontal brain, where we humans do our reasoning. KPFA is a different kind of medium. We present ideas challenging established notions, and especially those promulgated by government and corporations. And we ask you to think, make your own conclusions, go explore, use this as a beginning, go on the internet, form your own conclusions. 1-800-439-5732 to support this vital institution. There's not a KPFA party line, nor should there be. We want to be a vehicle where many views can be heard. So please make that happen. 1-800-439-5732. There are almost 250 programmers who come into KPFA in the course of a week or 2 weeks. Far more voices than you'd ever hear on a commercial station, even though far less money flows through KPFA than flows through a commercial station. So you have the diversity of backgrounds and viewpoints, and people hail from all around the Bay Area. 1-800-439-5732. Please do your part to keep us on the air. If you can manage that $100 pledge, which, as Peter said, you can spread out over 12 months, then you can have the two-hour incontrovertible DVD as our thank you gift. But please call right now, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. As we've said, Incontrovertible focuses on the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7, and it emphasizes interviews with police and firefighters who dispute the official version of why the building fell. During our interview with Tony Rook, we played two audio clips from firefighters. Now we're going to hear the opinions of three police officers interviewed in that documentary. In this next clip, the first voice we'll hear is John Meters of the CHP. He's followed by Mary Revelle, retired from the Jersey City, New Jersey PD. Finally, by Ray Savage, who retired from the Sussex, England Police Department. John Meters, whose voice we hear first, asks why the World Trade Center site was not investigated as a crime scene, but instead the wreckage of the structure was hauled away and sent to China for the steel to be recycled. Here are those guests.
We should have many more police officers speaking up because it's so obvious. All you got to do is look at the 9/11 Commission report and say, well, wait a minute, they left out an entire building. I mean, we don't work that way as police officers. When we're assigned to investigate a collision, a three-car collision, if we don't have three cars in that collision report, our sergeant will jump down our throat. This is ship evidence over to China to destroy a crime investigation the way we did. I mean, it was completely destroyed. Police officers should look at that and say to themselves, that's the crime right there. That needs to be investigated. You can't sit up there and destroy a crime scene the way we did without investigating, without photographing, without analyzing evidence, without going to witnesses and getting full statements.
I am a retired Jersey City police officer who served 23 and a half years for the Jersey City Police Department. Jersey City is directly across the Hudson River from World Trade Center. There's no way. You don't need to be an expert to see that. That building was brought down on purpose, with purpose. And if they had said, oh, we're going to take it down on purpose and we're going to plant certain explosives to bring it down, it wouldn't happen in 3 hours or 6 hours. It would be 3 days or 4 days of preparation to make that happen. And I don't see that happening there. And that's just a legitimate question. Anybody with a brain could think that.
Are you aware of, do you have other fellow officers that are aware that the official story just, it doesn't sound true?
Yes. Many police officers who think about it say, well, that doesn't make sense. Yes. But there was one in particular on my job, and basically they gave him a psych evaluation, which they see if he's able to carry a gun. Now that's your livelihood.
So after he started asking questions.
Yeah, well, you know, he was putting things online, saying, well, what about this or what about that? And basically, they will threaten your livelihood. If you have children or you want to keep your job or retire from a pretty good job, if you keep everybody busy, you know, with the wrong reasons, they can't find the right reasons. And there was quite a lot of money being spread around, not to investigate, but almost to take their minds off investigations. We're going to have terrorist training. We're going to have new radio systems to communicate better. There was so much money being thrown around that the investigations were virtually stifled. And anybody who asked questions were, in my opinion, stifled.
when I saw the evidence of Building 7 and the collapse of that, I'd actually seen many controlled demolitions, actually police one or two. And, you know, when I saw that Building 7 pancake, I absolutely knew that that was a controlled demolition. There was just no doubt in my mind from the experience of seeing demolitions as a police officer, having to go there and actually put throw a cordon around the building whilst it was pancaked down. So that really had me questioning. And then, of course, when I saw the BBC News programme, the 24-hour programme with Jane Stanley announcing that Building 7 had fallen, and seeing the disparity of the time, you know, I think it was about a 20 minute in advance, obviously, you know, she had very strong psychic powers, or perhaps the script was read in advance, and that's certainly the version that I prefer to believe. So really, my whole questioning of that incident started then, and I really started to dig into what was going on. The motivation behind 9/11, I think, is manyfold on quite a number of different levels. On one level, there is obviously the excuse, and it was obviously very much planned beforehand. I think when you read some of the documentation, PNAC, the project for the New American Century that was written well prior to 9/11, is a very well resource document now that, you know, that's very available. You can actually see that 9/11 was a false flag event that was planned to bring about the ability to go into the Middle East and establish bases in the Middle East. Obviously, it was partly a resource-based situation, but really to establish a stronghold in an area where resistant pockets of strength were going to be attacked.
And this is the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest in the studio. Peter Phillips is joining me on the phone. And we just heard some sound bites from Incontrovertible, the DVD that we're offering as our premium this hour at 1-800-439-5732. Incontrovertible takes a look at the collapse of World Trade Center Building 7 on September 11th and emphasizes interviews with police and firefighters who dispute the official version of why that building fell. We just heard some remarkable comments from these three who were interviewed for Incontrovertible. The first one, John Meters of the CHP, asking why elementary police procedure wasn't followed in the case of the September 11th attacks. He compared it to a car accident in which if three cars are in the accident, you'd have to account for all three of them. In this case, they not even secure the crime scene, and the steel was shipped away to be recycled before the collapse of the building could be investigated. 1-800-439-5732 if you'd like to have a copy of this full two-hour DVD, Incontrovertible, produced by a British filmmaker. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Anthony Fest, joined by Peter Phillips on the phone. Peter?
Yes, it's 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HKPFA. And if you're listening to us now, we'd really like you to make that call, 1-800-439-5732, or do it online at kpfa.org. That supports this show, the Project Censored Show. It supports transparency and truth and information about 9/11. Incontrovertible is the newest film. And Project Censored has, for 15 years, covered issues around 9/11, and certainly for the past 6 years on KPFA, we will, when new information comes out, cover this as a topic. And we think that this is a very important new film that's available now, and it coincides with the release of the 28 pages. And that's really an important piece of understanding what's going on in the world today. And Tony Rook's movie was described by California Highway Patrol Sergeant John Meters. Simply put, it's the best film he's seen on 9/11 and the best film he's seen all year. So here's a chance to really have a better understanding of what's going on in our world and the impacts that that's had the last 15 years, and the war on terror and the justification for the invasion of Iraq and all of those things that came out of 9/11. That we really want to have full understanding about. So call 1-800-439-5732, www.kpfa.org, and make that call to support the Project Censored Show and support, more importantly, Mickey and myself and Anthony, we're all volunteers here at KPFA along with 180 other folks, and we need that support to keep the lights on and keep this 59,000 watts going. So thank you very much for making that call.
Yes, indeed, and we have some thank yous to offer right now to people who called 1-800-439-5732. Peter, you and Mickey live up in the North Bay, and it's a strong base of support for the Project Censored program up there. We want to say thank you to Pat from Sonoma, Felipe from Santa Rosa, but we're also hearing from the Crescent Peninsula and South Bay. We want to thank Renate in Cupertino, Joan and Lawrence in Menlo Park. They all called 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and made a contribution to keep KPFA on the air. The importance of this incontrovertible DVD is it takes a different perspective. I mean, you and I and the vast majority of our listeners are not cops. We don't think like cops. And yet this CHP officer asked a very elementary question. Why was the crime scene not secured? Why was the evidence not investigated? In fact, why was the evidence hauled away? 1-800-439-5732. You can obtain a copy of Incontrovertible and not only hear these guests, but see them as well, the full two-hour DVD. 1-800-439-5732. As we've been saying, most of the interviews in Incontrovertible are rank-and-file police or firefighters. And in fact, Tony Rook, the producer, told us that the DVD is intended for an audience of police, firefighters, and military as well. However, those voices are supplemented with other voices as well. Now we'll hear first Richard Gage. He's from the organization Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He's followed by Niels Harrit, who's a professor of chemistry at Copenhagen University. They're disputing the conclusion of the investigation by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. That report from NIST says that fires inside Building 7 caused its steel frame to weaken and eventually to fail. These commentators say not so.
At 5:20 in the afternoon, Building 7 drops like a rock, top to bottom, in 7 seconds. This is clocked by physicists, and it's free fall acceleration, just as fast as dropping a bowling ball off the top of the building. For at least 2.5 seconds, the physicists say, it came down at free fall. NIST originally denied this, saying, well, if it came down at free fall, that would mean there'd be no structure, the columns supporting the building. 40,000 tons of structural steel is designed to keep that building from going anywhere. So NIST is forced, in a public conference by members of 8E911 Truth, David Chandler in particular, to acknowledging that, oh, yeah, I guess it did come down by free fall. And they admit that in their final report, but they do not acknowledge the implications of that, which are that all of those columns had to have been removed at once, all 80 columns on each of at least 8 floors, because that's the distance for which the period of free fall occurred, 2.25 seconds, according to NIST. So this is rather incredible. You cannot have a building falling at free fall, which means not one of those columns gave any resistance, without all of them being taken out by explosives.
We're talking about the laws, fundamental laws of physics. We're talking about Sir Isaac Newton's laws of motion. And according to these, this is impossible unless you have applied some force to make the building fall. Gravity cannot do that, because when a building is in free fall, all the energy of the building is going into accelerating the building down. There is no energy left for breaking thousands of steel beams and girders. This is completely basic physics.
And that was Neil Niels Harreth, professor of chemistry at Copenhagen University, disputing the report from the National Institute of Standards and Technology here in the U.S., which said that fires inside Building 7 caused its steel frame to weaken and for the building eventually to fall. Another point that's made in this documentary, incontrovertible, is that were that report correct, a steel frame building collapsing from fire alone, that would be the first time that's happened anywhere. If it did happen, that suggests it could happen not only in New York, but any other place, San Francisco, Singapore, anywhere. So that suggests that firefighting procedures need to change. Now, Building 7 had been evacuated, so there were no casualties when it fell. But what if firefighters had been in that building thinking they were safe, that it wouldn't collapse? Of course, they'd seen what happened to World Trade Centers 1 and 2, but those were struck by airplanes. So it's suggested here, in incontrovertible, by firefighters, that if the NIST report's conclusions are correct, firefighting procedures worldwide are going to have to change. Firefighters can't be sure that they can enter a steel-framed structure where a fire is underway and not have it collapse underneath them. 1-800-439-5732 to obtain a copy of this thought-provoking documentary, Incontrovertible, from British filmmaker Tony Rook. 1-800-439-5732. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Anthony Fest with Peter Phillips. Our premium for this hour in the KPFA Fun Drive is Incontrovertible, the DVD from Tony Rook, newly out, and we just been hearing segments from it today on the Project Censored Show. 1-800-439-5732. Please make that call now. Peter?
And we really need your support, particularly for the Project Censored Show. Last week, 30 folks called in, and we really appreciated that. And we're getting a number of people calling in today, but I'd like to see it go to 60 folks call in right now. You know, that's the time. It's a time to think about the important issues that KPFA brings forward, that free speech is about open discussion, that 9/11 it should be a topic that is factually reviewed and an ongoing basis with new evidence that's being presented, which is exactly what we do. And we think that that's very important in a number of areas, whether it's the war on terror or Palestine or fluoride or whatever issues. We want to bring forward the information that's factual and filled with information, and that's what the Project Censored Show is about. So call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, online at kpfa.org. Wherever you're listening, you can make that call right now. We've just got about 10 minutes left in our show today. We would like your support. We'd really like you to give us a call, 1-800-439-5732.
And as I've said before, the September 11th attacks are the pivotal event of this still young 21st century. Besides the loss of thousands of lives in the attacks themselves, they, of course, provided the pretext for the Afghan and Iraq invasions, which have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives, as well as the pervasive spying and security apparatus we find now at home here in the U.S. So it's only appropriate to continue to question the official story, and where that question is coming from architects, from engineers, from emergency responders, from a physicist, all the more reason to disseminate it. Please call 1-800-439-5732. Support this institution, which is doing that disseminating, KPFA Radio, 1-800-439-5732. Here's some more callers we have to thank. Jeffrey from Richmond, Jeff from Novato, and Midgey from Dublin. Thank you, all three. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Peter?
Well, thank you very much for those that called in. And I'm still shooting for 60 folks for this hour, though. We really would like your help. 1-800-439-5732. There's thousands of you listening. And think of yourself as one of those that maybe haven't made this pledge yet, that you would like to know more about this information and the topic. Maybe you're a 9/11 person who already knows there's a problem, but maybe you've never even thought about this, or you've been afraid to think about it because, you know, 9/11 is like conspiracy theories, you know, and it's been labeled like you're crazy to think that way. And that's just not the way academics and people work. I mean, if there's issues, we should be able to openly talk about them and be able to talk about these issues frankly and straightforwardly with factual information. And this film, Incontroversial, gives you an incredibly important look at the overall circumstances of what happened on 9/11. So call 1-800-439-5732 right now.
And we've seen just in the few audio clips that we've played today on the Project Censored show from this two-hour documentary what happens when people question the establishment line. We heard of the firefighter in Scotland who lost his job. We've heard of the retired police here in the U.S. who say they're not sure they could say things like this if they were still on duty. 1-800-439-5732. So on both sides of the Atlantic, you have this pervasive pressure to not speak out. You may theoretically have freedom of speech, but if you don't have freedom of speech in the workplace, or if there'll be consequences in the workplace from exercising your freedom of speech, how real is that freedom of speech? 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We're about free speech here at KPFA. We want to question authority, question the establishment and its line. 1-800-439-5732. Please make that call and pick up a copy of the DVD, Incontrovertible, which also, in its way, challenges the official line. 1-800-439-5732. It's primarily about Building 7, but it also looks at some of the events that followed, notably the invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq by the U.S., in which British forces also took part. So filmmaker Tony Rook takes Prime Minister Tony Blair to task for going along with Bush. 1-800-439-5732. We also hear an interview with the father of a U.S. Army veteran who committed suicide after coming home from Iraq. These consequences. 1-800-439-5732. If this information matters, please support this station, which brings it out. 1-800-439-5732. Peter.
Well, in the film, is Cynthia McKinney. She's interviewed about the death of Martin Luther King, the assassination. And, you know, a civil trial occurred that proved that military intelligence and the Memphis police were involved in a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. And, you know, if those government entities can be involved in an assassination, and certainly the assassination of Kennedy was in that group, and Bobby Kennedy too, that by every means, elements, deep state elements of our government, other governments, could be well involved in 9/11. And it's important that we keep that as a factual understanding of what is possible. That we keep exploring, we keep asking, we've got to know the answers. We have to really understand that. So there, you know, and not feel repressed. I know certainly people are afraid in their job that they get too out there, and thank God for tenure at a state university, our colleges where Mickey and I work, because we can openly talk factually stuff. And I mean, this isn't anything that's crazy or weird. I mean, it's what is important, and it's what is academically factual information. So this Incontrovertible film is that way. I've reviewed it. It's certainly an important piece. We've got a number of people testifying and saying this is very important. 1-800-439-5732. Please call right now.
Your call supports Project Censored program. It supports Flashpoints. It supports Guns and Butter. It supports the Women's Magazine, Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and so many more shows, including the rich array of music programs. But as it is the Project Censored show right now, let's take a quick look back at some of the topics that have been covered in the last few months alone on the Project Censored show. We've had guests rebutting some anti-Black Lives Matter commentaries that were circulating in the corporate media. They told us, for example, that on-the-job deaths of police are much lower now than they were in the 1980s. There was coverage of the Whistleblower Summit. Peter, you yourself spoke about the Bohemian Club, which you've investigated as a scholar. Prior to the conventions, we heard analysis of the two presumptive candidates who did indeed become the nominees, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Among the perspectives were a guest who told us why many neoconservatives were switching from the GOP and were going to support Hillary Clinton. 1-800-439-5732. We also went local a few weeks ago. We had a look at the Berkeley Public Library, where troubles are going on there with a top-down administration accelerating the discarding of books, reducing the authority of librarians. Chris Worthington was our guest, as well as two retired Berkeley librarians. That was a Berkeley story, but it had implications around the U.S. where similar things are going on. 1-800-439-5732 supports all this work. 1-800-439-5732 supports the work of the 200-plus staff here at KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. Peter.
Well, you know, it's always fun to come in and do the show. And High Wire Coffee Roasters is there. The Stella Nona Restaurant brings in some specialty foods and cakes and desserts. And, hey we really like volunteering at KPFA, and it's an important thing to do. Mickey and I and Andy have done this, and Anthony have done this now for almost 6 years. And I know that Anthony's been there much longer than that. So you're supporting a whole network of folks that look at very important issues. I mean, one of the issues that we did this past year was we talked about the Roe versus Wade implications for vaccines, the idea that people have the right to control their bodies and not be forced to take vaccines if they don't want, if they choose not to. So there's a lot of important implications on a variety of very controversial topics. And we ask you to make that kind of support. 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org. We just got a minute or so left, and we ask for your support right now.
Yeah, we're down to less than 30 seconds. And as you said, Peter, that vaccine issue was a prime example of the adage that the personal is political. 15 seconds left. 1-800-439-5732 to support the breadth of coverage here on the Project Censored Show and on KPFA. For a $100 pledge, pick up the DVD, Incontrovertible.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. From Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima. In common history, Pearl Harbor and Hiroshima represent the beginning and the end events of World War II, suggesting that the attack on Pearl Harbor forced the U.S. into war and that the bombing of Hiroshima saved the lives of 1.5 to 1 million U.S. soldiers. With help from long-ignored or classified information, Arjun Makhijani reanalyzes both events. This talk, given to Nuke-Free Now in August 2012, near the Los Alamos Weapons Lab, presents thought-provoking information about how nuclear weapons were invented and who really was in control of their first use. Makhijani, with a PhD from UC Berkeley for his work on nuclear fusion, has long explored the role of scientists in the Manhattan Project. In part one of this talk, Makhijani asked the audience if they knew the engineer and inventor Vannevar Bush. Very few raised their hands, and Makhijani remarked that that was sad, since Bush was, quote, the principal architect of my story. Vannevar Bush was the first presidential science advisor and coordinated around 6,000 scientists who were working on war technologies. He was director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development in the Roosevelt White House, the very organization that initiated the Manhattan Project. At the end of part one, Makhijani raised the baffling question how it had been possible to exclude almost all military and civilian leaders of the World War II war effort from the Pentagon to Congress and the U.S. government, including even the vice president, from knowing about and influencing the Manhattan Project. He is Arjun Makhijani.
Most generals who were prosecuting the war had no clue about the Manhattan Project. They did not know it existed. They were not told. Even Admiral Leahy, who was Roosevelt's liaison with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with the generals in the Pentagon, and Leahy worked in the White House, he found out by accident when Lord Cherwell, Churchill's science advisor, was visiting Roosevelt in 1944, and Cherwell could not imagine that Leahy would not know about the bomb project, and he talked about it. That's how Admiral Leahy found out. MacArthur was informed by memo on July 30th, I believe, 1940, what do you think? July 30th, 1945, that this bombing was going to take place. He also had no clue. The list is pretty long. The people on this committee, chair was Vannevar Bush. He had James Conant, the two scientists. They didn't let any of the other scientists know anything of what I'm going to tell you. So they were supposed to be representing the scientists, or so the scientists may have thought. General Groves, of course, who was the executive director of the Manhattan Project, effectively. And then there was another general who was part of the construction, General Steyer. And there was an admiral, Admiral Pernell, who was in charge of new weapons in the Pentagon. There was no liaison with what was going on in the war. So nuclear weapons are already detached from the war effort. May 5th, 1943, will you promise to help me make this date famous? May 5th, 1943, the Military Policy Committee met to review the progress of the project. The last paragraph in the minutes relates to targeting, and I believe it was the first targeting decision that was ever made. So they decided to detarget Germany. They decided they were not going to target Germany. It wasn't because of race. So far as I can tell from this and other research, there was a lot of racism against the Japanese. Of course, you know that. We know that. There were all the internment camps and so on. Plutonium was race-free, as it turned out. The Japanese were selected for targeting. This is a quote. As they would not be so apt to secure knowledge from it. The it refers to the bomb in case it is a dud. So the whole reasoning was, what happens if the bomb is a dud? The Japanese would not be so apt to secure knowledge from it as would the Germans. So the Germans had Heisenberg. It was not a racist thing. It was a good evaluation. So from May 5th, 1943, to the bombing of Japan, Germany was never targeted. It was not. There is no evidence to that fact. Churchill and Roosevelt, when they met in 1944, actually Churchill said something like, after mature consideration, we might use the bomb against Japan. Churchill did not, so far as I know, ever raise the question of the bomb being used in Europe against Germany. When Truman became president after Roosevelt died, as vice president, did not know about the Manhattan Project. In fact, he has written a threatening letter as a senator that you're spending all this money in 1944. If you don't let me investigate it, and they didn't, there's going to be some price to pay if I discover race, fraud, and abuse, which is still a common phase. We're still waiting to discover it, right? So Groves briefs the president in April 23rd, I think, 1945, and he tells the president, the target is and was always expected to be Japan. I wasn't the first to discover this. These memos have been declassified. This has been written about in the official AEC history of the war, and first in the 1960s of the Manhattan Project. But I do think I can claim to be the first to see the significance of this. So I interviewed the scientists in an article I wrote for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. So I called up Robert Serber, who worked with Oppenheimer. I called Joe Rotblat. I was privileged to know Joe. And I called up Glenn Seaborg for separated plutonium. I called up Hans Bethe, the director of the theoretical division in Los Alamos during the war. Good people. Not a single one of them knew in 1995. They all believed the bomb was used in Japan because the war was over too soon in Germany. They were surprised that Germany had been detargeted in 1943. So now Joe Rotblat's decision to leave assumes a greater significance. But think that if you have contributed to the destruction of two cities, how much curiosity should you have about what went into the decision? This is an important question I would like to ask Los Alamos scientists. So, we know the sequence to the bombing of Hiroshima. Now in 1944, the United States is looking to the end of the war. Dean Acheson was the Secretary of State. Do you know what his memoir was called? Present at the Creation. He testified to Congress, you could probably fix it so that everything produced here would be consumed here. Mark these words. That would completely change our Constitution, our relations to property, human liberty, our very conception of law, and nobody contemplates that. Therefore, you must look to other markets, and those markets are abroad. Enter the nephew of Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War. The nephew of Henry Stimson, Alfred Loomis, was a Wall Street banker, an amateur physicist, who had a mansion in a place called Tuxedo Park. And many of the famous physicists passed through Tuxedo Park, and the invention of radar started in his basement. Fermi went there, Lawrence went there, Niels Bohr went there. He's one of the most colorful characters in American history. Some economist is supposed to have sent, I think it was Loomis who sent a note to his uncle saying in early 1945, look, the Soviets are occupied a good bit of Europe. 200 million people are in that part of Europe. We're going to lose those markets to socialism. So he writes this long memorandum. Let's compromise with the Japanese so that the Soviets don't enter the war in the East and occupy China and Japan, and we lose those markets too. And so let's give up unconditional surrender. Let's give the Japanese Korea, you know, let's throw something nice to the imperialists. So the Wall Street will come out well. And by the way, I think 500,000 to 1 million lives would be saved because American soldiers wouldn't be forced to fight the war to the end. So now you know where that number first came from. So Stimson sent this to General Marshall and said, give me your review of this. General Marshall sends it off to his general staff. General staff sent back a note saying, we don't think we should give up on unconditional surrender. And we think that the estimate of 500,000 lives saved by not invading Japan is, quote, entirely too high. Okay. General Marshall forwards the Stimson. Policy is maintained. Now come July 1945. The Japanese are at the end of their ropes. Cities are being firebombed. Their supplies are cut off. Their people are starving. Their soldiers who are out, you know, in the far posts have little to eat. The war was essentially over 6 months before that, at least. The Japanese are wanting to surrender, but they want their emperor to stay. The Japanese militarists, this is a Japanese, when I say Japanese, I mean the Japanese ruling class. Nobody consulted the public. For the Japanese ruling class, the emperor staying was more important than the lives of the people. Between the Potsdam Declaration, when they said unconditional surrender, and the bombing of Hiroshima, I think 10,000 people died in firebombings. Now, they said emperor must stay. This message was conveyed by the Soviets, who were not yet in the war, to the Americans. Americans replied, unconditional surrender, no deal. Americans, of course, at this time also had broken the code of the Japanese, and they knew all of this. The Soviets didn't have to tell them that. Meanwhile, the bomb is ready. MacArthur has been informed, and it is used on the first day that the weather permits. So this is very important to understanding. As important as everything else is the fact that the bombs were used as soon as they were ready. First bomb on August 6th, second bomb on August 9th. First clear weather day. Actually, the target was not even clear weather for the second bomb. Nagasaki was kind of picked up as a target. It was not on the original preferred target list because it had already been damaged by prior bombings, and they wanted, there was an experimental aspect to these bombings. It was not the main aspect, but they wanted to know what bombs would do on undamaged cities, and some cities had been named as not to be bombed. The Soviets entered the war just before the bombing of Nagasaki. What happened in Japan on August 6th? Of course, they knew time is up. The next 9 days have an immense debate around them. The best that I can tell, they knew this is a new weapon. The Japanese still want the emperor to stay. They still are not ready for unconditional surrender. The Soviets enter the war. This is a big shock because the Japanese are still hoping that the Soviets will mediate a surrender with appropriate conditions. Soviets enter the war. Truman has said, before the bomb test, I think, in his diary, that Soviets enter the war, Japan will surrender. That was his view. But after the bomb test, the U.S. actually did not want the Soviet to enter the war because of what I have told you. The idea was we should keep the markets. So Okinawa has been conquered, and things have been stopped at that point because the next step is very big, which is the invasion of Kyushu, the southern island of the main part of Japan. And this, they knew, would be a very big deal. And so it was not due to start till November 1, almost 3 months. Now, here's what totally convinced me that the bombings are completely illegitimate. Now I have told you what I think. Is because they themselves believed that the Soviet entry may precipitate the surrender, and there is no price for the Americans to wait for 10 days. No price. Soviets could not have occupied a big area in a day, right? It takes time to move those armies. But they decided to use the bombs. And the second bomb was used also as soon as. In the end, the Americans apparently covertly agreed to let the emperor stay. So the emperor of Japan and the elite of Japan, even after two atomic bombings, did not care enough of their own people to agree to unconditional surrender terms. This is a very important thing to know about the Japanese militarists. So if you think that Americans are responsible for that decision, and I think they are, because it was their bomb and they decided to use it, you have to think who was in charge in Japan. This is very important for us to acknowledge. This will start a conversation in the United States. And I want a broader conversation to start. I have done this in the panhandle of Texas, in the home of farmer friends. And my farmer friends in the panhandle of Texas said, let's go and get rid of nuclear weapons. Let's get children out of the way of war. That's why I'm bringing you this message, because I am convinced that this message is more truthful. And I see Gandhi t-shirts here. I admire Gandhi most for two things. And there are things I'm very critical of Gandhi, as an Indian especially. The bringing of truth into politics. That's why I regard him as the greatest political person in history. And he said, if you want a good result, you've got to have a good process. We haven't had a good process so far because we have not acknowledged the truth in the other side. All right, a couple of other things. So I promised you I would bring civilization back into this picture. When Stimson briefed Truman after he became president, April 1945, here's what he told Truman. If the problem of the proper use of this weapon can be solved, we would then have the opportunity to bring the world into a pattern in which the peace of the world and our civilization can be saved. All right. Now you must reflect on the character of the civilization. Here in Los Alamos, on August 6th, Richard Feynman, a great physicist, and I believe in 1980 became a greater man, remembering August 6th, he said this. The only reaction I remember, perhaps I was blinded by my own reaction, was a very considerable elation and excitement. And there were parties, and people got drunk, and it would make a tremendously interesting contrast what was going on in Los Alamos at the same time as what was going on in Hiroshima. I was involved with this happy thing at the same time as people were dying and struggling in Hiroshima. This was an interview with the BBC, I think around 1980. Then he reflects, with regard to moral questions, I do have something I would like to say. Because the original reason to start the project, which I had, was that the Germans were a danger. But what I did, immorally, I would say, was to not remember the reason that I said I was doing it. So that when the reason changed, which was that Germany was defeated, not the singlest thought came to my mind at all about that. That meant now I would have to reconsider why I am continuing to do this. This is from one of the most brilliant physicists in the 20th century, which was full of brilliant physicists. I simply didn't think, okay? That's what he said. Now, I think the people who repeat this thing about 500,000 to 1,000,000 lives saved, I would bet the vast majority of them have no clue where it came from. They also don't know what the general said, which is something between 20-odd thousand American lives would be lost and 46,000, I think. And they had various scenarios for the war. There's actually cable correspondence after the war when somebody said 200,000, I believed it was Henry Stimson, that should we correct the Secretary of War because the estimate was tens of thousands. And the overall decision was don't get mixed up in it and give the Japanese a propaganda advantage. And then Truman wrote 250,000 in the first draft of his memoir, and then he felt it wasn't good enough. And in the final version, which was published, he said, and I believe this is pretty close to an exact quote, General Marshall told me that 500,000 lives would be saved. And I have just told you what General Marshall forwarded during the war to the president, and Truman was president in June, that contained a slip from the staff evaluation saying that estimate was entirely too high. But I can give you some facts that throw some doubt on this assertion. I really want to enter into a conversation with Los Alamos scientists about this, because they're wedded to the bomb by habit. They're wedded to the bomb because, as Mr. Truman is supposed to have said, that the most sensitive nerve in the human anatomy runs through the pocketbook. And I actually have reflected a lot on this, and I think all of us who live in civilization, and this is part of the character of civilization, have rerouted our entire sensory systems through our pocketbooks. Of necessity, I'm not condemning it. I'm saying if you want to extract yourself from the worst moral consequences of the kind of civilization we live in, then we must recognize the truth of this. I don't think Los Alamos scientists will listen to me.
But I hope that they respect Richard Feynman. I would not put Richard Feynman on the same plane as Joe Rotblat, who is the only hero scientist in my book. Joe Rotblat quit the Manhattan Project when it became known that Germany did not have a viable bomb project, but he was the only one. Well, there was Leo Szilard, who started the thing and tried to stop the bombing and went to Jimmy Burns, who was Secretary of State, and said, really, don't do this. And one of the main reasons for dropping the bomb, and I'll stop here, was that the expenses on this project needed to be justified. Groves has said, and this is a paraphrase, that if the project is seen as a success, we will be celebrated. If it is seen as a failure, Congress will investigate, nothing else. So this was a dominant reason for the rush. But I believe those who have said it was a message to the Soviets and the world are also right, because Groves has said the bomb project was carried out with the idea that the Soviets were the enemy. It's interesting, so many vignettes. DuPont ran Hanford, where the plutonium was made for the Nagasaki bomb. But do you know that Groves thought that he didn't have the time to investigate DuPont and their fascist connections, and that he would trust their patriotism to do it right? At a time when they kept the Manhattan Project secret from all but a handful of members of Congress, and I do not believe even a handful of the actual leaders who were responsible for the conduct of the war. But I will leave you with this, that our side, who wants disarmament, has been, not everybody, has been a little afraid of the truth. As a result, we have been painted into a corner that the right wing may well call the dump on America crowd, you know, often called that. And I would say, if we reflect on it really honestly, you have to say that giving such a one-sided view of what happened in World War II lets too many parties off the hook, including the Americans. Because if you don't ask what the fleet was doing in Pearl Harbor, you'll never understand about oil or the Indonesians. So if we want disarmament, we must be bolder and start a more respectful conversation. We need a better conversation with Los Alamos, and we need a better conversation with the American public. I'm convinced that nuclear weapons have become today, from a high-tech instrument, a monopoly of the most powerful in 1945, to an instrument of terror of North Korea, which is an impoverished state with lots and lots of hungry people. It has become an instrument of response of the poor dictators who want to terrorize others, instead of the instrument of domination of the rich who want to terrorize others. And nuclear weapons were built. The whole of air warfare was designed as a warfare of terror. It's a next talk. But please, take this away. Process is very important, and we must not forget Pearl Harbor nor Hiroshima. We must understand both things, and we must bring more of the truth to Los Alamos and the country, because the other side isn't going to do it. Right? You know, the nuclear power companies aren't going to rush and say, let's have a carbon-free, nuclear-free economy. Are you seeing them rushing? They say, well, let's put solar on the table, let's put nuclear on the table, let's have a smorgasbord of energy, and we'll all be happy. So let's do that. Thank you very much for letting me do this and inviting me.
That was the conclusion of the one-hour talk From Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima by Arjun Makhijani at the Nuke Free Now conference in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on August 4, 2012. Makhijani, originally from Mumbai, India, holds a PhD in engineering from UC Berkeley for his work on nuclear fusion. He's president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Maryland. The website is ieer.org. Thanks so much to KEXP Seattle program host Mike McCormick for sending me the audio for this program.
And we're back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and to the rest of the world at our online streaming service, cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Very pleased to say, as earlier we had mentioned, we are going to be on with Anne Garrison. Now, she's quite a prolific personality. You'll find her on Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. You'll find her at Global Research, Counterpunch, Black Agenda Report. Those are some of the online publications that she writes for. She has a recent one on Counterpunch. We'll be talking with her about that. But I think we have her on the line. Anne, are you with us?
I'm right here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, this is great. We love it. You've got a lot of attention and followers on your Facebook account, and now you've got some recent stuff about Trump versus Hillary and the Greens on Counterpunch. Today, we want to talk about the Green Party campaign, and there's a lot we want to investigate there. But before we go into the details of the party and the campaign and Jill Stein and everything, there's a pertinent issue that presents itself immediately to me, and that has to do with the fallout from the Democratic convention. You know, with what happened to Bernie Sanders' campaign and what they did, I'm wondering, people must be looking at third parties quite seriously now. I'm wondering, are Bernie Sanders supporters coming over to the Greens? Is there evidence of that? Or how's it looking as a result, especially of the Clinton candidacy?
Well, there's no doubt about that. There were quite a few Bernie Sanders supporters who said all along that they were going to switch their support to Jill Stein if Bernie endorsed Hillary. And as you know, Jill Stein asked Bernie to join the Greens, offered him the top of the ticket. He said no. He never even responded. I think Chris Hedges said something very important about this. He said Bernie Sanders turned his back on his most important historical moment. If at the DNC, he had stood up and said, this process wasn't fair, I'm leaving, I'm walking out to join the Green Party or to make an independent run, his delegates would have walked out with him.
Yeah.
Now many of them are confused, don't know what to do. But they're definitely Bernie supporters defecting to the Greens. The information on it so far is kind of anecdotal. Pew Research came up with a poll in which they said that 10% of Sanders supporters would support Jill Stein. But who knows how they asked the question and who they were asking. I'm here in Houston for the convention, and there's some people from Austin, Texas here, and they say that everybody in Austin who was supporting Bernie is now supporting Jill Stein, and someone actually rented them prime office space for very little money because he supports the Stein campaign.
Wow. Okay. Well, that certainly is supported by some of the chatter that we're seeing on the internet, on social media and elsewhere. As other commentators have pointed out, you know, the Sanders campaign, whether or not it was being used to you know, rope in left supporters and young people, it seems to have created a movement in some respects is beyond the control now of the Democratic Party and the DNC. And we saw evidence of that at the convention itself. I mean, a number of prominent individuals seem to have given support over to the Greens. We can talk about the VP pick, but I understand Cornel West is actually someone who is endorsing the Greens. Is that right?
As soon as the platform committee meetings were over, where Cornel West put up mighty objections to what went into the platform, most notably what went in about Israel and Palestine. And he crossed over to the Greens as soon as the platform committee meetings were over. He said, if we're going to go down, I'm going to go down with Sister Jill.
Right.
And he pointed to how dire our circumstances as people living on the planet are.
Yeah. This is someone whose opinions on a lot of matters related to U.S. politics are taken very seriously. There's also the VP pick that we heard about recently. But I guess, you know, and we get into that issue for our Canadian listeners. They might not be too familiar with the U.S. Green Party. I mean, it's had some notable candidates. But in terms of its positions, its platform points, and Jill Stein, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what the party's about or what kind of alternative it's trying to offer to the two-party system right now?
Well, the Green Party around the world shares something called the four pillars. And if I can rattle them off, they're diversity, decentralization, ecological wisdom, and now I'm going to forget the first. I think economic justice. And some parties have a variant on the four pillars, elaborating on them, called the Ten Keys. Jill Stein is advocating decentralization, local food systems, local sustainable food and energy systems, greater community. You know, we're all isolated and dependent on these huge, unsustainable energy and food systems. Which are highly centralized, so that the people who own and control them can vastly concentrate wealth in their own hands.
Yeah. You mentioned that there's an international component to that. That's interesting. Of course, there's green parties in a number of countries, Canada and elsewhere. You've done research internationally on other green parties, I think, including in Rwanda and some of the difficulties they face there. I mean, this can be very difficult if you're not a mainstream party. There's certain issues when you're dealing with a duopoly in the United States. One of the problems that all third parties face is being called a spoiler. You know, we had to deal with that in the case of Ralph Nader, who we all remember, if anyone was alive at that time, was blamed. He was blamed for the loss of the election to George W. Bush by Al Gore.
And they still bring up the N-word all the time. The people who make the spoiler argument, they bring up the N-word.
Nader.
And I don't think we're taking that very seriously this time. I'm encouraging people to say, well, Ralph did not cost Al Gore the election, but so what if he did? It's an election.
Well, people act as if the Bush campaign and the victory of the Republicans was the end of the world. It was a very destructive presidency, but I think what people are missing is how do you lose to George W. Bush? You know, how do you get into a point where you're locked into a 49%, 51%, 50-50 split with George W. Bush? Now, the problem that the Democrats had was they actually won that election, and the Electoral College screwed it up, and then they didn't contest it. So they were given the option to say, we don't want Bush in, we think it's really bad for America, and he stole the election, and we won. But they didn't actually do that, did they?
Well, wait, they didn't do what?
Well, they didn't fight for their own election.
They didn't fight, no. I mean, Al Gore took the case to the Supreme Court, but he didn't fight further in other ways that he could have. And when it was stolen then in 2004 in Ohio, John Kerry more or less said, okay, can I go home now? And I think it's very important to understand in this election now that in poll after poll, Bernie Sanders beat Donald Trump by a greater margin than Hillary Clinton, and the disapproval ratings of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were really high. So the elite Democrats and the Democratic National Committee were more concerned about stopping Bernie Sanders' campaign for equality and climate justice and the other things that he represented, controlling the banksters, than they were about stopping Trump. If they had really been concerned about stopping Trump, they would not have sabotaged the Bernie Sanders campaign the way they did.
Well, that's very interesting you bring that up. I think that's a very valuable observation, because now all of the Democrats are bullying people all over the place, on the internet, wherever you are. They're saying you have to vote for Hillary. You have to vote for Hillary or Trump gets in, and it would be so bad for America if Trump got in. Well, actually, Bernie, as you said, Sanders was polling better than Clinton against Trump. If you wanted an anti-Trump candidate, you would have put in Bernie Sanders and thereby defeated Donald Trump. But instead of doing that, they deliberately chose to destroy the Bernie Sanders campaign. And those emails have come out now, which have shown that they did conspire to do what they could to keep the Sanders campaign down, suppressed, broken, so that Hillary could win. So their primary threat, their primary objective seemed to be to destroy the Sanders campaign, not Donald Trump. And now they're going around telling everyone you have to vote for Clinton, an unpopular candidate, or Trump's going to get in.
Yeah, we had an experience in the San Francisco Bay Area that has some parallels. In 2003, a Green Party candidate, Matt Gonzalez, who later ran with Ralph Nader as his vice presidential candidate, was running for mayor. And I've never seen people excited and mobilized about that race in any other situation. Except maybe the Bernie Sanders campaign. People were really excited about the Bernie Sanders campaign. But the idea that a member of the Green Party might be elected mayor in a major city like San Francisco so upset the Democrats that they sent all the heavy hitters. They hit both the...
Well, that's odd. We seem to be having a phone issue with Ann. Let's take a moment, call back, see what happened there. And
okay,
if
just catch me after the music.
And we're back. Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU. I think we may be back with Ann Garrison in the United States. Ann, do we have you on the line again?
Yes, you do, and I'm sorry about the crackle on the speakerphone.
Oh, well, I'm glad we got you on your mobile now, and so yes. That's fine. Yeah, we're sorry about that interruption. You know, we were just talking about the issue of spoilers, Ralph Nader, and then the Democrats getting rid of their strongest anti-Trump candidate and then blaming other people if they don't succeed against Trump. But you point out there's a whole long history to this. I think you were talking about San Francisco.
In San Francisco in 2003, Matt Gonzalez was a Green. He was on the Board of Supervisors. He was running for mayor. There was a huge amount of energy behind that campaign, a huge amount of progressive activist energy. And the Democratic Party was so horrified by the thought that a Green might become the mayor of a major American city like San Francisco that they sent all their heavy hitters. They sent the Clintons. They sent the Clintons again. They sent Jesse Jackson. It seemed like they tried harder to defeat Matt Gonzalez in that mayoral campaign than they tried to elect John Kerry the next year.
Yeah. No, it seems that any threat to the duopoly is taken very seriously. But we're still being coached by all sorts of figures that we all got to line up and vote for Hillary Clinton now. And I think on Counterpunch even, we've been seeing a debate. Noam Chomsky and some academic colleagues have been saying basically you have to vote for Clinton, or we're recommending that people vote for Clinton, and especially in swing states or whatever, contested states. And the reasoning or the arguments they're giving to left-wing people is they're saying, if you vote for a third-party candidate like the Greens or someone, and then Trump wins that state, then you are responsible for the things that Trump does as president. But they don't make the same argument. They don't say, if you vote for Clinton in order to prevent Trump, they don't say that you will be responsible for acts that Clinton does, wars and bombings.
There's a case to be made that Trump is a better candidate. Sure, he's racist, he's sexist, he's homophobic, he has horrible taste, he owns gold toilet seats. I mean, he's like, ew, he's everything that makes liberals squirm. And he's the worst on all the identity politics issues. But he has also gone on record against the TPP, said he wanted to renegotiate NAFTA, said that pharmaceutical companies should have to negotiate with Medicare over the price of their bills instead of charging whatever they please. And he's gone on record in opposition to so-called humanitarian wars. he hasn't gone so far as to say they're not really humanitarian to debunk the R2P mythology, but he has said they're too expensive.
Well, we're being pitched, Hillary, as a lesser evil candidate. I mean, we're now in the sad state of people having a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And so people are trying to say, well, in this case, we have to vote for the lesser evil. But I think the problem with this reasoning is this has been going on for a while. The Democrats run against all sorts of outrageous people and say that you have to vote for them as the lesser evil. Where has that delivered us? That's delivered us to Clinton versus Trump as the primary candidates.
Exactly.
So, I mean, lesser. If you're going to vote for evil, or what you call a lesser evil, you're going to still end up with evil.
And the Democrats will never give us anything so long as they can count on us voting on fear of the Republican. But the Republican is not more frightening. They're both horrible. It's taken billions of dollars to nominate two of the worst people on the planet.
Well, I guess in that case, what you need to do is you need to vote for something that actually represents you. What does the saying go? I'd rather vote for what I want and not get it than vote for what I don't want and then get it. That's a famous labor slogan. And, you know, so people have to vote for what they want. And, you know, their third parties are suddenly becoming a lot more interesting to a lot of voters in the United States. You have I noticed the Green Party has its VP pick now. Isn't that a gentleman from Counterpunch, actually?
Counterpunch and the Black Agenda Report. He's an editor and contributor to the Black Agenda Report. He is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and he's the founder of a human rights organization. I think it's called the International Human Rights Network, but it's different from the big NGOs like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, one of which, Amnesty International, he had some past association with. But I'm just learning about this organization, but it's more about empowering people to demand and secure their own rights.
Mm-hmm. So for a very grassroots orientation, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a grassroots human empowering human rights organization.
Well, I've read his.
We have some of this coverage of Africa in common, and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International both make my hair stand on end in that part of the world. I'm sure you've heard the critique of those organizations that they're very involved with the State Department.
No, yes, you've done very good work on the subject, and certainly we need a greater diversity of human rights, or what they call human rights organizations, NGOs, grassroots groups, and so on. And looks like your VP pick may represent some of that. People can go to Counterpunch and look up his articles just as they can yours. But you've pointed out this is a very depressing election. A lot of Americans feel that way. In the case of alternatives and voting for the Greens, I'm wondering about your thoughts on the viability of the campaign. I mean, can Jill Stein win? Is the campaign viable?
Well, she probably can't win, especially because she cannot get into the debates. If Jill were allowed into the presidential debates, and if John Mubaraka were allowed to debate Mike Pence and Tim Kaine, the response that got the candidate who got such a response from the Bernie delegates, then it would be a whole different story. And there was a lawsuit filed in 2012 against the Corporate Commission on Presidential Debates, which controls who gets into the debates. I don't know at what point that lawsuit is right now. Litigation takes years and years, so it might well still be on. But the rule now is, I believe, that Jill would have to get 15% in three nationally recognized polls to be allowed to get into the debates. And it's very hard for her to get to 15% if nobody can see her. Most people get their news and their information about the presidential race from TV. And if they're not going to see Jill on TV, then they're not going to know she's an option.
Well, this is very troubling. You've pointed out a structural problem here, and that is people are on the lookout for alternatives. There's a most, I mean, it was what, 7 or 9% of Americans that basically picked Trump and Clinton. That was the percentage that was involved in those decisions. So for the other 90% of Americans, they're looking for options. There's Bernie supporters that are looking for options. You know, his sort of capitulation to Hillary there was seen as more, he did more than necessary to stand down there, and it upset a lot of his supporters at the convention. So there's people that are looking for alternatives, and yet it's very difficult for anyone who's not part of a two-party duopoly to get on the ballot, to get on TV, and so on. Is there enough measures being taken to raise awareness of this issue across the United States? You know, are people learning now, perhaps, or perhaps the hard way, that if you want to get someone beyond the Democrats and the Republicans, that you're going to have to enact some kind of structural change just to have a voice and be heard in an election campaign?
No, I wouldn't say people are getting that. And if you're talking about American politics, one of the first realities you have to consider is disengagement, that the American electorate is most fundamentally disengaged. I'd say isolated by all the large systems that we're all dependent on, that keep us from seeking community or solutions with our own neighbors, because we're all dependent on these vast energy and food systems, energy, food, and media systems that most people don't know their own neighbors, and usually the majority of Americans don't even vote. It's rare to have an election where more than 50% of the population votes. When Barack Obama was elected, that was a high, that was the highest percentage of voter participation in decades. I can't offhand remember how many decades, but it was extraordinarily high, and that election could not be stolen. Neither of the elections could be stolen from Barack Obama, because he won by such a wide margin. Only a close election can be stolen.
So, well, one of the problems that you're lacking in the United States is a sense of community, to have people discussing and being involved in things. It's something that you actually need in order to move on to the next step, which is to be fielding third-party candidates and things like that. It sounds like you have a tough situation to deal with there, unfortunately, but I suppose we all knew that going in. Making more...
Well, it's not just tough for us. It's tough for the rest of the world. I mean, I try to imagine people in other parts of the world who are so vulnerable to what we're going to do next, watching these warmongering clowns stepping up to become the next commander-in-chief.
Well, I wish that you were wrong, but actually, unfortunately, that's true. The choice of the next president will dramatically affect people all over the world. And I don't think they're looking too happily at either of the two presidential choices. Trump has had a lot of heated rhetoric, and Clinton, we have a record. People talk about her foreign policy experience as a reason to vote for her. But when we think about foreign policy experience in Clinton's case, we know that her major actions as a politician in the last 8 years have been to enact military aggression in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere. This is the department that's supported a coup in Honduras is one of the first things that happened when Obama got in. And there's going to be more war, more responsibility to protect, more Samantha Power type intervention. So, unfortunately, you're right. Despite American disengagement, their president is going to have a dramatic impact on the rest of the world. And we don't get to vote. We don't get to vote in Canada. They don't get to vote in Libya. They don't get to vote in Nigeria. They don't get to vote anywhere. So if we don't see more positive engagement by citizens, of course, not only the United States, but the rest of the world is looking at calamity.
I mean, there's a fundamental flaw in democracy as we understand it, which is that a country with an overwhelming military domination of the world, like that of the U.S., can vote and to elect someone who makes war on much of the rest of the world who didn't get to vote. It's a fundamental problem and a reason, an argument for international law, that although, you know, that's sort of an ideal, it's way out of reach if you've considered any of the international courts and the way that the UN works.
Yes, it's all very, but, yeah. These are.
There's something else I want to say about Jill and Bernie Sanders, in contrast. Bernie Sanders advocated climate justice and the idea of a Green New Deal, something like Jill's. But Jill's, I mean, Bernie's advocacy for that was not realistic because he didn't have a foreign policy that went with it. The Pentagon is the world's largest consumer of fossil fuels. It's the largest consumer of coal-to-liquid transport fuels made by the Cecil Corporation in Africa, in South Africa. And, in fact, the fossil fuel emissions of the Pentagon, the number, the measure of them, is a national security issue. It's a secret, because if the world knew the size of the Pentagon's fossil fuel emissions, it would be a national security issue.
Yes.
So when you hear how high the U.S. is in its fossil fuel consumption, that's not even counting the Pentagon.
The Pentagon may well be the largest polluter in the world. Certainly, the emissions from all those jets, ships, aircraft carriers, rockets, the amount of fuel that tank battalion consumes. People have put those figures on the internet. It's all very staggering. And behind all the talk of green this and sustainable that, the United States military is an enormous consumer of energy and creator of emissions and pollution and so on. It's hard to put a realistic facade over that. It is a very serious problem. It means that green plans that don't address the U.S. military footprint all over the world with its 800 bases are very compromised. Well, it's all very you've painted a very hellish portrait of the difficulties they're all facing in the United States. We'll have to give more attention to third parties and see what people are doing about this to get some kind of representation in the United States. These are two very unpopular main candidates. Their unfavorables are the highest anyone can remember, and these are the people that we have to choose between unless the third party.
But I'm excited. I'm excited because third parties are getting attention. Jill is getting attention. I flew out here. I was sitting next to a gentleman from St. Croix, and he knew who Jill Stein was. And he asked me how many Bernie's voters would migrate to Jill Stein. People all around the world know who Jill Stein is now. And, you know, she's part of the conversation far more than she has been, or the Green Party has been, in the past. I mean, in some ways, it may have to get worse before it can get better.
Well,
but I'm excited because we're at least part of the conversation now.
Well, it looks like there have been steps then. You know, we're in a period of transition. The issues about globalization and war and other unemployment, job loss, free trade are tearing up the major parties, both the Republicans and the Democrats, and it is a time mm-hmm. in which new parties and other forms of change can emerge. So, of course, we're going to be keeping a close eye on that. It's at stake for everyone, not just the United States, but as you pointed out, the rest of the world. So we'll be keeping an eye on that, and people can, of course, tune into Counterpunch to find your articles on that subject. So, Anne, thanks very much.
Oh, and I would recommend reading Ajamu Baraka. I just started doing this myself. I had read some of his work, but now that he's our VP pick, I am reading all of his articles on Black Agenda and Counterpunch, and he's an extraordinary writer, very, very insightful and gifted with language, and he has a lot of insight and activist experience about both African America and the African continent. That's really exciting.
Of course. Well, we can find both of you at Counterpunch, www.counterpunch.org. So I'm looking forward to that. So, Anne, thanks very much for being with us today.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Sure. Thanks. Bye-bye. That was Anne Garrison, who writes for a number of online publications, Counterpunch, Black Agenda Report, other places. And also she's radio journalist herself, covering Rwanda specifically. We caught her in the middle of a convention that's going on with the Green Party, in the middle of a hive of activity.